the reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home, is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
You get another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit. Oh.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from me. Stay away from me. I'll come in here. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon that all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you!
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
I'm well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Good. And in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
This is Abe here. Hi.
Hi, Abe. How's it going?
All right.
And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
Good. Very good. Thanks.
Excellent. All right. So who we are for new listeners, we are Dark Discussions Podcast, which is part of the Dark Discussions Network, www.darkdiscussions.com. Basically, we try to talk about genre films, so horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, midnight movies, cult films, and the like. Basically, talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. We do have an email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, where we will read your email on the podcast. So your thoughts on any of our topics, ideas, questions, and whatnot. Also, Dark Discussion 1 is our Twitter. And then we have a Facebook group called Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, and you can join us there in the conversation. Eric, what else can folks find on the website, darkdiscussions.com?
Oh, I don't even know anymore, Phil. It's all rearranged. they can find, of course, all the episodes of this podcast that have been released available to download. They can also find all the other shows available on the Dark Discussions Network. And also, you can find a link to our Patreon account. Patreon allows you to financially contribute to the show if you so desire. Producing the show is not free. We have to pay for things like website hosting and movie rentals and equipment and so on and so forth. So if
hookers.
You'd like... No, we don't spend the money on hookers, Mike.
Where are you getting yours for free?
I'm not hiring hookers. You do you. So before I was so rudely interrupted, I was saying that Patreon is a service that allows you to contribute to the podcast. If you'd like to do so, you can head to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on any page of darkdiscussions.com. For every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly do a show on. Every quarter, we take all the submissions and pull one at random to do a show about. So if you'd like to contribute, we'd certainly appreciate it.
Yep, excellent. Very well. And that is true. So it would be great help if you chip in. Let's see. We actually may be getting some writers for the website. That's possibly coming up within the next couple of weeks. So we'll see how that goes. Basically, we're always looking for people who want to review Blu-rays, review brand new VOD films, review any film, review screeners, and so forth. If you're interested, email darkdiscussions@aol.com. All right, so for one other house cleaning thing, it is September 24th, 2020, for some folks who like to know when these are recorded, because sometimes they are released a few weeks and then sometimes a couple of months later than the recording. Yeah, in one case, the Ozark, for example. And that is for Pam, one of our listeners. All right, I think that's pretty much it. If we have any news or things we've been watching, whatnot, we can discuss those at the end of this episode, and so forth. So, Eric, what is our discussion for tonight?
Tonight, we're going to be talking about a movie available on for digital rental called The Honeymoon Phase. You know
I love you, baby. The Millennium Project seeks married couples to participate in a 30-day research study. Payment, $50,000.
We don't even know what this is.
I can assure you, it was a group of romantics who, I must confess, got a little obsessed with love. Hope you all enjoy your stay here.
Welcome to orientation. I'm your handler. It's a pleasure to make your acquaintance. These headsets will record your brain waves as we discuss your experiences over the next month, hopefully leading us to uncover the truth behind the honeymoon phase.
I love it.
Hello?
He's not the man you think he is.
I love that trip.
Tommy photoshopped you in. Ever since we got to this house, things have felt off.
If you can't trust me, maybe our relationship isn't strong enough.
I've been informed that you've been experiencing paranoid delusions.
From your file, I didn't think you'd make it past the first week.
What are you saying?
Hey!
How do you know it wasn't real?
I was with you.
Don't tell me to calm down. She's manipulating us.
You're the one running away, not me! I love you. And you learn to love me too.
That's right. The Honeymoon Phase is a 2019 film that was its production date, and it did festivals and whatnot back then. But it was released August 21st, 2020, everywhere, specifically everywhere in at least the United States. So it's technically a 2020 film because of that. The film is first-time director of a feature-length film, Philip Carroll. And it stars a handful of people, with the two leads being Chloe Carroll, who is actually the wife of the director slash screenwriter, and Jim Shubin is the other lead. And then there's a couple of other folks in the film, including Francois Chow, who's a pretty well-known character actor. The film is a kind of a science fiction horror thriller-type film, mystery too. We'll get into all that during our discussion. So I guess we can go around and discuss how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. And I know, Eric, you were the first person to bring it up because you noticed it or something. So how did you hear about it, and what did you think?
I actually heard about it because after we did one BR on the show, I started following Dark Sky Films on Twitter, and they were tweeting about it when it came out. So I added it to my watch list, and it's been sitting there for a little while, and I suggested it as a possibility. I like this movie. There are definitely some things I want to talk about with you folks. I thought it was well acted and well made. I have some story questions, because there are some things that threw me for a loop a little bit. I also just want to say the scariest thing in this movie was the bookshelf. because I'm not even particular OCD, but that crooked bookshelf was driving me batty. Every time it came into frame, it was driving me crazy. But I generally enjoyed this film, and I would recommend it as a rental. However, I do want to discuss some things with you folks that that I have questions about. So we'll save that for past the spoiler flag. But generally, I enjoyed the movie.
All right, very good. For me, I heard about this film basically because of you, Eric, when you brought it up last week as a possible subject. And then when Mike Stern comes around, he'll explain how we finally decided to choose it over all the other topics we were discussing. Me and my wife were looking for films. We had two trailers, Alone and this film here, The Honeymoon Phase. And my wife liked Alone better, the trailer, so we watched that one, and that was a damn good film. Possible recommend as an episode of Dark Discussions. I haven't mentioned it yet until now. And that was really good. But the next night, we decided to watch a second film, and so we chose The Honeymoon Phase, because she also liked the trailer for that as well. This film is... A truly intellectual kind of sort of science fiction film. Definitely horror elements and whatnot. I think I enjoyed it a whole lot. It was a really good film. The story was kind of interesting. There's a twist at the end that I did not see coming at all, and I don't know if that is because of maybe poor screenwriting or it was actually a really hidden gem, but either way, it was still a good twist. The two leads were great, I felt. For folks who aren't particular to intellectual horror sci-fi, it also has a lot of grindhouse elements as well, which will definitely bring in a number of folks to want to watch the film as well. So it has a lot for a mixed audience, I think. It was a thumbs up and recommend. Let's go with you, Mike, since you were the one that kind of pointed us into the film after Eric brought it up.
Yeah, well, first of all, if Poe-esque is Chrissy's drink catchphrase and drinking game catchphrase, I think Grindhouse has got to be yours. I'm not sure who's the first one to brought up on the podcast, because I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast. But I had gone to a couple of Poconos, film festivals in the Poconos, which are only about an hour from me, back in 2019. I think I had gone to two. The actress,
Chloe Carroll,
right, was there. She had made a short film. And I really liked her short film. She was there doing like a Q&A after her short film. So we got to talking, we connected on Facebook, and she had mentioned that her next movie, The Honeymoon Phase, was coming out. And there's like, was going to be debuting in, Philadelphia, I think is the end of November of 2019. Unfortunately I wasn't able to make it to that, but I've been keeping an eye out for it. And, so when, Eric mentioned it as a possibility, last week when running through it, I kind of jumped at it because I did like what they did before and I wanted to watch it, and I figured here's a good way to maybe toss some eyes in the direction of someone that I have a very loose Facebook association with. Yeah, you know, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, we're going to parties or anything together, but you know, so I could throw her a solid. Of course, we waited until we saw if the movie was any good or not. And I rather liked it. I'm kind of with you, Phil, in that I don't know what to make of the ending. I was kind of being set up for.
Yeah, that's
one particular ending. And when I say set up, I'm not saying that they necessarily were setting me up for it, as I am thinking I was expecting a certain ending. And then where I was expecting them to have a right twist, they had a left twist, and I did not see it in any way. And I'm not saying that the ending that they chose was completely out of left field. I mean, it was that it was like unsupported or contradicted what they set up before. It was just not at all what I was expecting them to do. And I still don't really know how I feel about it, but I did still enjoy most of it, partly because this is a weird thing. I'm noticing that when they set movies at Christmas, it somehow works a little bit better. I don't know what it is, like something adds something to the mood and the atmosphere. But really, I just enjoyed the leads. I thought they did a great job in the beginning of the relationship, portraying the honeymoon phase aspect of the relationship. And then as the things, spoiler warning, fall apart as the film goes on, I also thought that both leads did a fantastic job on that end as well.
All right, very good. Mike, I know you said you just have a loose friendship with her on Facebook, like a lot of folks, and you don't go to parties with her. But when you're outside the window when she's at parties, does that count?
I do not. That is a total violation of her privacy. I would never spy on her when she's at a party.
That is the best joke Phil has ever made on the podcast.
Oh, jeez. Sorry, Mike. I had to.
I would never spy at her on her in public.
Very well. Very well played, Mike. All right. So let's go with Chrissy.
I really was pleasantly surprised by this film. I love the opening. I just think the opening is really very well crafted in the sense that it's just like a well-crafted short story. You know, it kind of reaches out and grabs you by the balls and drags you in. And I just love that. There's a lot of conflict. I think the actors did a fabulous job, especially since they had to, you know, kind of morph and change in significant ways. I, too, did not see the twist coming at the end, but I do feel they were justified. I feel the script is really well done. I think this is probably one of the best unreliable narrator films, if you will, that I've seen in a while. That it was just very impressive. I give this movie a big thumbs up, and I think it will definitely appeal to, it's definitely kind of like a thriller or a psychological thriller, but I think it will also definitely appeal to people who like relationship centered movies. I don't want to say romance because this is not really a romance, but it is very much focused on an intimate romantic relationship. And so I think it will not only have appeal to people who like psychological thrillers and even horror films, I think this is going to have wider appeal than that. I feel confident that I could recommend this movie to people who don't watch psychological thrillers, and they will very much like this movie. So I thought that kind of cross-genre blend was very well done. So, yeah, I give it a thumbs up. I loved it.
All right, very good. Abe?
So I heard about this film because I almost made a mistake of watching the wrong film. I watched it today, though, to just keep everything fresh in my mind, and I'm glad I did, because it is a film with a lot of those hints and secrets. It's one of those kind of films that sets you up for something, as Eric and Mike have mentioned. I think I like the first half more than the second half, though I came away from the film liking it. Overall, I think there were some points where it was I can tell what it was planning at first. And when a certain twist happened or reveal, I felt that I could already tell that it was trying to go in a different direction. Maybe because what they attempted first felt too obvious to me. That being said, there was moments where I thought interactions between the cast, our two leads. Because even though there were a couple of little side characters here and there, it's mainly a two-person performance. You know, we spent a huge, almost like, I would say, almost 80% of the film with only these two actors. They do a good job. There are some really good, nice moments that are both that's still endearing in the beginning, but you get some really unsettling moments, and it's definitely, like, it's for a science fiction thriller, I can recommend it, but I think it's going to depend on the person, how they feel about it overall when they come away from it, just because of how certain things play out. You know, not everyone's going to walk away from it very happy, but I'm sure there'll be those who will be very satisfied. Overall, I did enjoy the film. Not sure how I would place it over this year's rankings, because it's not really a horror film. It's more of a thriller or science fiction thriller, or even psychological thriller. But it's certainly a one to, I think will be mentioned more than once, even after this episode, you know, concludes.
All right, very good. So, appears that it's anywhere between a hidden gem to a very high recommend. So, it appears we all like the film a lot. Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki. Struggling young lovers, Tom and Eve, must endure a 30-day scientific experiment. Room, board, $50,000, and a month alone together in a research facility housing. What could possibly go wrong?
Really shining her up there, aren't you?
There you go. Now, Mike, the lead actress, before we get into spoilers, we will just talk about everything and anything. I guess the wiki is decent enough. I did have a question from Mike. It is mentioned at one point that the lead actress character is from a foreign nation. Is Chloe Carroll in real life? It sounded like she had some sort of English accent or Australian accent or something.
I didn't remember picking one up at the. I'm not saying that she wasn't, because you know there's a lot of people at a film festival and you meet a lot of people. So I don't recall. I honestly don't know.
Okay, so maybe
hopefully
it
when we
been...
talk to her next week, get a hint.
Right. It could be just a part of the screenplay, and she, you know, had a small accent intentionally for the screenplay, because that was one of the small minor aspects of their relationship. So I was just curious, and if it was written real, or they just, you know, and they added it into the screenplay, or if it was part of the screenplay. But you're right, we can find out if we do have them as guests. All right, anybody else wanted to bring up anything that is general about the film? Let me ask you this. What do you guys think of these kind of science fiction-y films? You know, we've seen Ex Machina and Annihilation and various other ones that kind of tread right there on the horror side, but also, as Abe mentioned, thrillers, psychological thriller, you know, so the Venn diagram, it falls into many categories. In general, what's your opinion of this subgenre of genre films? Anybody want to give their thoughts?
I think it really allows us to explore certain aspects of human nature and stuff like that. Some of the times touch on subjects that we might consider a little too sensitive or taboo, or things that a different perspective might, you know, try to shed light on, or you know, or a different lens, as one would say. It's one of those things that, whether it's like, you know, what, you know, for example, when it's dealing with robotics or AI, you know, it's like what defines consciousness, and you know, what makes the soul or anything like that, or the idea of you know, where we want to go and explore, what kind of answers we want to find, or what answers we want to avoid. And this one is covering subject of relationships and the longevity of those relationships, and trying to, you know, what, you know, constitutes a perfect bond, or one that will last. As the doctor character mentions, is that, you know, what's the difference between like a marriage that ends very early to one that celebrates its 50th anniversary? You know, what is the key component there? And so it's exciting on that, and also just kind of how certain parts of a person can reveal themselves to their other significant other much later than they expect. Things that we might not, you know, really know about them, or a side that we wish wasn't there. So it does a lot of experimentation in terms of what kind of stories you can tell. And this one is telling them a more human one, even though it's, you know, in the realm of science fiction.
Yeah, and that's a fair point, Abe. To add to what you said, I would even add, we always hear that people should not, specifically women, should not get married just to get married. They should find a partner and someone that will support them and all that. And when that happens, and you lose that person, a part of your life, it's a loss, right? I mean, you know, it's almost like a death. So if you have a spouse that passes away that you love, or a parent, or God forbid, a child, or even a pet, something is lost. And you know, the difference between a marriage and those other items, even though you could say pets are similar to marriage, you choose rather than, you don't choose your parent and you don't choose your children, but you choose your spouse. But the aspect of that is similar to a parent or a child, and as I mentioned, even a pet, that if you lose that person, especially if it's not abusive, you know, it's a loving relationship, you lose part of yourself, even if it was by choice you chose that person rather than by birth. So I think that's
an interesting moment where you sometimes end up changing your part of yourself, something even unconsciously, when you establish a bond. You know, part of your life has now changed somehow, the way you live it or something like that. Even though, you know, the ideal is like no person should have to change a relationship, but some people end up doing so. Whether for the benefit of both themselves or their spouse, and you know, just how we're trying to find compromise, and you know, what way we can stay together, you know, because life has its own ways of twists and turns, and you know, a loved one could have a different, you know, desire of how a relationship or some direction in life they feel that could be best for the two of you. And we see this point here, in how our Eve and Tom start to divert in what they want in their own lives. I mean, there's more things than behind the scenes, but in that very moment there, we're seeing a very human moment where they totally have different ideas of what their life together should be.
Yep. What about you, Mike, Eric, or Chrissy? Any thoughts on this subgenre, or you know, families, relationships, marriages, and such that can be interpreted from, I guess, the main story? You know, after you boil away everything, it's a story of marriage, not just for the two lead actors, but even the doctor, as we'll soon find out. Any thoughts,
well,
anyone?
One of the first things Abe said I agree with, which is that movies in this subgenre can often be used to talk about things they're not talking about in the text, but rather the subtext, particularly sci-fi. A lot of the times can be used to illuminate other things, like, for instance, the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers has a heavy theme of McCarthyism going on in that movie, and intentionally so. But, you know, you ask the average moviegoer who goes to see that and ask them what it's about, they're not going to say McCarthyism, right?
or even straight communism too, because
they
also say that, you know, people are being taken over by the communists versus, yeah, but that's a good point.
So,
continue.
So I think science fiction and horror can be used to talk about themes bigger than perhaps the movie that's talking about them, without directly talking about them. And I think it's kind of a neat way for filmmakers to express themselves without, you know, making a documentary about what they want to talk about. I know it drives Mike up the wall, but I think it's kind of neat.
Sure. What about you, Chrissy or Mike? Any thoughts on any of the items that were discussed so far?
Well, I definitely agree. I think, you know, this does, I am going to actually watch this movie a second time, because I think for me, this is one of those films that just has a lot in it on a deeper level, thematically, with regard to, identity, perception is a big one in this. I had a friend of mine who always used to say that, you know, the real reason that any relationship falls apart is because the perceptions change. And this movie spoke that very loudly to me. Granted, it was doing it on an, you know, I don't want to throw out, we haven't done spoilers yet, but, so, like I said, I think it has a lot to say about identity. I think it has a lot to say about what we expect from others in our relationships, what we expect of ourselves in our relationships. And I'm going to watch it a second time because I know that there's stuff in there that I'm just not processing yet. So.
Sure, sure. What about you, Mike? You haven't said anything.
Yeah, I was waiting. Yeah, I like science fiction. I like horror. I like fantasy. So this is anytime you blend them together. Is good. I think we have become, you know, over the last couple hundred years, a society that puts a lot of our faith in science, so to speak. And science has replaced a lot of mystical thinking, sometimes with science fictional thinking, but that's a whole nother matter. But for example, once upon a time, someone might have told a story about a person being cursed to turn into a monster, and now we have Seth Brundle building a telepod and turning into the fly, right? And it's just a matter of substituting magic with fantastical science. And really, there's nothing in this story until they get to the ending that couldn't have been told as a thriller, just about you know, a woman who marries somebody who is not who she thought. You know, and that relationship changing. But by doing the science fiction element, you can add some more fantastical stuff to it and maybe therefore spin it in different directions. You know, Eric mentions Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I mean, the classic example is the old Twilight Zone, you know, which Rod Serling wanted to do because he could talk about things, you know, if he wanted to, that he would never be able to get if he talked about them.
Outer Limits.
Openly, right? Well, Outer Limits. My problem with Outer Limits, I when I binge watched it every week, it was nuclear war, right? And I understand it was the '60s, the height of the Cold War, so that was a thing on everyone's mind. Where Twilight Zone some sort of shook up the themes. They often came back around to Cold War and fears of nuclear annihilation, but it seemed at least the first season of Outer Limits was like every episode was getting back to the idea of nuclear annihilation. But certainly, yeah, there's that. But I mean, there's all sorts of prejudice and, you know, racism and paranoia. You know, the Monsters Are Due on Maple Street was one about, you know, people's fear and paranoia was a great episode, and stuff like that. So yeah, it allows you to talk about things that are hard to do. Now the problem is we've kind of gotten to the point in this country, thankfully, where a lot of these issues you don't have to speak about slyly. Right. If you want to make it something about racism, you can make something about racism. You don't have to speak about, you know, like imply it because you're afraid of TV censors or the film board shutting you down because you're talking explicitly about something. You don't have to use coded language to deal with homosexuality or domestic violence or anything like that. You know, we can, you know, deal with these things a little bit more openly and honestly, which I think makes it a little harder than for a lot of these things, because they don't need to tell the stories that way. But I do think it allows you to tell it in a way that's interesting and it's different. And yes, sometimes you can put things out, you know, that are less obvious. I think, you know, we talked about It Follows, which I don't know if that's science fiction or fantasy or where that fits in as a horror subcategory.
Best film ever.
But right, that really is a story about life and growing older. And losing your childhood and facing your mortality. And it deals with it and talks about it in that way. The Midsummer was about the ending of a relationship. Now, I think in this honeymoon phase, if you know you've ever been in a relationship, it is not necessarily referring to when you first get married. It's referring to the beginning phase of a relationship, when you're first in love with somebody and you get that infatuation, you know, and, you know, she hasn't had a chance yet to get the restraining order. So, but that's a thing that doesn't last. It can't last, right? I don't think we could survive emotionally with that level of obsession. You know, I think we would just get emotionally exhausted so quickly. You know, you eventually move into a more comfortable relationship, especially when you've been in a very long-term relationship. You know, it is not exciting. I think, you know, couples are like, they've been married a long time. So I miss the exciting days. Can we go back to that? Well, not necessarily, not easily. And when you look for that sort of excitement, that's often, I think, where, you know, maybe people start to go astray. Because the other parts, the long-term comfort and security, you know, the cozy blanket at phase of marriage is really, really hard to replace. It's very easy to kind of just get into a new relationship and feel that excitement. Getting that long-term distance relationship is another thing entirely. But it is a nice thing when you get it. But yes, there's always the risk that, you know, you find out the person you're with is not the person you thought they were. You know, and sometimes it's a matter of drifting apart. I've always thought, you know, when you look at these celebrity marriages, you know, like between famous, you know, your J-Lo's and Brad Pitt's and whatever, that I think one of the problems is that they spend so little time together, it's very easy to drift apart. You know, when you have, you grew up with the same town, to the places, went to the same, you ate at the same places, you all kind of people while you were there and grew up together or changed in similar ways. But once you're out of school and you go to college or get a job, then your experiences start to diversify and you become different people. And you start changing. And when you get back together, you maybe don't recognize each other as much and you have less in common. And you always end up falling back on the stuff that got you together up until you were, you know, again, back when you were children, because maybe you don't have this common ground as adults. So here it's a matter of, right, the characters are changing their priorities. Now, they're doing it in a very compressed time frame. That's the science fiction aspect of it, you know, where, you know, one seems to be giving up the husband is giving up his dream or faux husband of being a writer and changing his thoughts on having children. I never really picked up what her thoughts were having children were initially. So I really wasn't sure about, or maybe I missed it or I'm not remembering it. But yeah, I mean, you do get those things. And the reality is, as you get older, you do kind of change your preferences. Pam, my wife, had no interest in poker when we got married. And now that's like all she does, you know? So I was not podcasting when we got married, you know, so things change. But hopefully you change together and, the relationship is able to sustain.
Very well. There it is.
And the death of any animal is far, far more tragic than the death of a human. Let's be clear about that.
Indeed. All right. So let's discuss. Well, it depends on who the person is. Right?
No, we know that people don't care when people are killed in movies. They all care when the dog dies.
Yeah, that's true. Well,
that just proves we don't want to admit it. But animals are better than people, and that's why we care more about them getting murdered in the movie.
Fair enough. All right, so I guess we can probably throw up the spoiler alert, so we're going to discuss...
It's kind of hard to talk about a lot of spoilers.
Yeah, so we'll talk about everything and anything, specific plot points, symbolisms, critiques, all that good stuff. Obviously, we don't have to go... scene by scene, because you know anybody could just watch the film, and we don't have to just commentary on that. But we're gonna talk about anything and everything, and the spoiler alert is up. So yeah, where do we want to start? What do people want to discuss?
Let's start with that fucking bookshelf.
I knew that was gonna bug you even more than me, Mike.
No, it didn't bug me at all. But man, it bugged the shit out of Pam because she is definitely OCD. Right, she's the person that when we play Trivia Pursuit, if she gets up to go to the bathroom, we move the pie pieces on her little piece so that they're out of order.
Oh, does she have to have them in the same order that they're on the board?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know people like that. That bookshelf was a nightmare, to be sure. No, but I want to talk about just something interesting to note, is that probably within the first 10 minutes of the movie, I watched it with my buddy Dan and his wife Susie, and we're all sitting there, and like not even 10 minutes in the movie, or actually, no, correct that, 10 minutes past the point where they end up in the house, I go, are they in some, or actually I start by saying, oh no, and Dan goes, what? I go, are they in some sort of VR? And he goes, I was thinking the same thing.
All right, raise your hand if that's what you were thinking.
This is an audio podcast, Mike.
I count five people. Okay.
Was everybody thinking that?
I was.
I was not. I was
okay.
One point was, you know, I thought that it was each character's push was being put in some kind of a reality and having a simulation of some kind of life with the spouse.
Because, yeah, so that's where we were thinking. And then when the reveal comes along, I actually had some issues with the reveal and the twist, because it seems like that they made such a point out of hiding what the reveal was going to be that it didn't make much sense when it got there.
Right.
Because they didn't do much to set it up.
Right.
So when it finally comes along, I'm going, wait, what? And I've got a lot of questions about what was actually going on during the whole thing. Because now I'm asking myself questions like, was it the same two people the whole time?
Right. That's a fair point.
I think the only one that was being played around with was the husband.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I honestly think the ending came so fast, because really, I mean, it is the last, what, 15 minutes of the film, maybe?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Martin Candle throws the exposition at you so quickly.
Right. Well, and Mike, also the setup that Eric's mentioning, and where I said, is it poor screenwriting or was it just hidden very well, which is the few times she says he's not my husband, or they'd say he's not really who he says he is. They're not things that you would think, okay, he's been cloned or something, or he's a robot or something like that. You're thinking he's changed as a person. When she says, you're not my husband, we're thinking she's saying, you're not the man that I married or want to marry. And when the woman doctor says it, we're thinking that, okay, he is part of the whole program. And so I don't think anybody predicted what the final thing really was, which was Chow's, or whatever the doctor's name is, the actor's name's Chow, what he was really going for with the experiment. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I thought, so when they first go in for the experiment, they're separated.
Right.
And then they show them experiencing their new home wearing what looked like, you know, they're wearing VR goggles. So again, mm-hmm. that whole VR thing. Yeah. So my assumption, my suspicion was that husband is over in one VR simulation, wife is in another simulation.
Right.
And it's sort of like a controlled experiment, and they're
going
to try to make, and they're
going
to make the, like, and she's living in an experiment where he's becoming more and more dickish, and then maybe they're doing a thing with him where she's turning into more and more of a harpy as that's going along. Right. And they're trying to drive a wedge between them or whatever. Just they're testing to see what does it take to break this apart or whatever it may be. Because when you volunteer for experiments, sometimes knowing what the experiment is about ruins the experiment. So when you're testing it with human beings, if you tell them we're testing you to see if this makes you feel happy, you know, then you can end up screwing up the effects because they're expecting to feel happy when you do it. Mm-hmm. So here they may not have been honest about what this experiment was about. And so I was, and then when things start getting supernatural and to me relying on one of the worst and almost overused tropes in the horror science fiction.
I said it to my wife and she said the same thing, which is only in the movies does a woman throw up when she's pregnant.
No, no, that's not true, but it's not, but that's not the one that I was talking about. Okay. I mean, morning sickness is a thing, but it's only in the movies where morning sickness is 100% thing.
Yeah.
But no,
well, it's just an easy, I think the reason we always see that is just because it's an easy indicator. Huh? What'd you say?
It's a lazy screenwriting.
Well, but it's just an easy indicator so that the audience kind of knows. Yeah, it's like even people who don't know anything about being pregnant or the stages of pregnancy understand that the throwing up in the middle of the night or the throwing up in the morning, they automatically know what that means.
I get
and
it.
I think that's why they use it
so many damn times.
Oh, I know. It's tired. It's
well,
tired.
And if I understand the numbers correctly, you know, it's something like a third of pregnancies have morning sickness, except in movies and TV where it's 110%. Right.
Yes.
And
in movies,
and the other
way you find out you're pregnant.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the other thing is that she goes to the toilet, she bends over, she vomits. I think I'm pregnant. Not like maybe the salmon eggs I had for dinner last night in the industrial packaging were bad. You know, no, it has to be pregnancy. There can't be any other possible solution to that, even though we've been using birth control.
Well, and okay, here's another question that was driving me crazy, is that she starts showing like they're in this place for 30 days. And either in that 30 days, she gets pregnant and starts showing, or I guess, are we to believe that the whole birth control sabotage had been going on a long time? And
no,
she
it's
pregnant when she
no,
walked in?
I think
it's an accelerated
clone.
Pregnancy.
Yeah,
I think it has to do with the whole cloning thing.
Yeah.
So
right,
is
that
clone?
No, I think the baby they put in her is a clone because it's his semen,
oh,
right?
Oh, so it wasn't actually a natural pregnancy.
Correct.
Well, yes, it was natural in that it came about the old-fashioned way because otherwise there's no need for the sabotage condoms, but it's coming from genetically engineered semen.
Huh. Right. The clones are made in a way to be able to breed quickly so they can make more.
All
right. Now, for me, again, this is the cliche I was talking about, which is the fantastically accelerated pregnancy,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can get a whole pregnancy into a 2-hour runtime, whereas, you know, in reality, you could just show, like, you know, editing of the calendar changing pages.
Right,
instead
right.
of making it 30 days, just have them living together for, oh, I don't know, let's say 9 months as part of this experiment. Yeah, so there were ways that they could have done that if they wanted to. So to me, it's a cliche. It's not a make or break thing. It's kind of, you know, like I'm not going to roll my eyes at every action movie because the hero runs away from an explosion. You know, I'm just kind of assume that now, and if I'm watching a movie that's a horror movie or science fiction and there's an unwanted pregnancy, the baby's coming hot and fast, you know, just with it, you know, it's just going to be a souped up like one day per trimester kind of thing.
I have one more question that really confused me, and then I'll stop nitpicking, which is there's one scene where a woman runs up to the door. She's all bloodied and she's pounding on the door trying to get in, and a guy drags her off. And then they show a recording of it where there was nobody there. What was that about? Did that actually happen? Or if
okay,
not, what's the deal?
All right, here was my thought on that, Eric. Is that this movie, again, is exquisitely crafted because you've got some unreliable narrator stuff going on, not only from the, you know, Tom's point of view, but also from Eva's point of view. However, you also have this weird house with a lot of weird technology in it, right? And so I think what happened is it really did happen, and they were somehow able to filter it out, maybe, using manipulation, or there is a possibility that, I don't know, perhaps there's some kind of glass in there where, like, a camera will not see what's going on outside.
And,
you know,
because the husband,
they show this place being very advanced. Mm-hmm. So,
and,
you know,
and the husband agreeing with the video saying there's nothing there was him being a clone already. So he was going to be on board with whatever they told him, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Is my guess.
Well, yeah.
Because why else would he say, what are you talking about? There's nothing there. You know, you see the video. I saw it. There's nothing there. He had.
Well, the reason is because she's crazy and was hallucinating.
Well, that's the case. She's an unreliable narrator. The whole film, she could just be an unreliable narrator, too.
Uh-huh. Well, I think this also kind of hints, that whole thing I think did happen. And I think it was meant to also hint at the violent and unstable nature of the clones. Because these clones, they're being made to be perfect in a certain way. They have the right genetics of personality and stuff like that. But each of them seems to have a fault to have outbursts of violent behavior. The other husband and, of course, the clone of Tom, both at certain points are set off into be violent and unpredictable.
Well, I just want to back up a step to make sure I understand what you're saying here. Because when you said the clones are designed to be perfect, you mean perfect replicas.
Yeah. Well, okay. They also have the desired kind of genetic memory and everything like that.
Because Tom was not a good dude, right? We're led to believe at the end of the movie.
The clone version of him.
Either version of him. Because the person we see talking at the end of the movie, isn't that the real Tom?
I was led to believe it wasn't.
Yeah, I was led to believe that she killed the wrong person. And I'm thinking there may have even
been... See, I'm going to have to watch this again because none of this was clear to me.
Right.
Yeah, the ending felt a little on the rush side. So then, again, that's where I was feeling a little... I think I've got whether you're going to watch you. Understand what they're trying to do. He bring back his wife. The director, the head of the thing.
The doctor that's running this experiment lost his wife, and he's trying to get her back.
Right, and so the problem is if you were to make a clone of someone,
she died.
Right, if we were to make a clone of Abe right now, you would just get a clone of Abe that's 25 years younger than Abe. He's an identical twin, much much younger. How old are you, Abe? Now, 29 years younger than Abe. Sorry. It would just be his identical twin, 29 years younger. It doesn't get any of his memories or anything like that. And so they've come up with a, science fiction, hocus pocusy way to give the clone memories. It doesn't mean it's going to come out to be the same person. So I think what they're trying to do is they're doing all these experiments and they're cloning everybody's partner, everybody's husband. I don't know why they're doing the husband in the hopes to see, like, can they get one where they make someone who is
exactly the same.
Whereas obviously in this case, Tom is not exactly the same. She sees the differences because once they figure out maybe Tom doesn't come out exactly the same, but Mr. Schwartz over in lab number 17, he does come out exactly the same. And so they can use that technique to try to bring back the director's wife so that he gets the exact same wife that he lost.
Okay.
So, except that she's going to find out her husband's like now 25 years older.
Right. So they're doing basically like 50 different experiments with 50 different ages. And so, you have case 1 to 50. And as they ruled out, he's hoping at least, say case 37, it worked. Aha. Uh-huh.
Right.
So this is what we're going to do to get my wife back.
Right.
So
see, because I was looking at it the other way, which is that she did kill the right one, and they did clone him accurately, and it turns out he was a psycho.
Yeah, but that would be out of character from what we saw prior.
I was just looking at the issues. I was just looking at the position of where they were in the hallway. I knew she killed the wrong guy.
Yeah, that's what I did too. I think they were trying to make you think she got the right one.
Yeah, but they play with that classic scene where it's like, no, I'm the real one. I'm the real one.
Shoot us both, Spock.
Yeah. Right. Right. But Abe is
isn't there still the possibility that they cloned Tom accurately and he was just a psycho the whole time?
Yeah, but then it's not his baby though, right?
Right. And also Tom wasn't a psycho prior to that. So
how do we know?
Well, right. But that's fair. We wouldn't know, but
there's one way to know. Did he have a podcast?
Well, right, but she put it this way. She knew the difference that he was not the Tom that wasn't the psycho. So,
why'd she kill the wrong one?
Because
make up your mind.
She had a minute and a half determination to make that decision, and she fell for the psychopath because psychopaths are excellent liars.
Now, I kept wondering if Eve was always Eve. You know, I thought both of them were the twist was going to be that they were both clones,
right. And that's what you said, Eric, too, right? That maybe they're switching.
I don't know anymore. Am I? I don't even know.
No. I mean, and now that I've had time to think, right? I'm starting to ask other questions, such as, and again, I'll go with Hitchcock here. It doesn't matter if you're thinking about this. Thinking about this a month after the movie, which is the it's whether or not it's are you thinking about the time? Did anybody walk out of this experiment alive? Did they try to impregnate every woman in this experiment?
If they did, some of it would obviously be completely implanted pregnancies, because you know there's a number of women in the experiments, in these 50 cases, there's a number of them that are past menopause. So,
right. I mean, so
question.
But like, they just murdered this woman. Did they? I mean, the whole point was, hey, we're going to pay you $50,000 to spend a month with us, right?
Yeah.
And they grant people in all phases of their relationship and all phases of the marriage, and so you have to figure, in order to get this to work, they're doing this hundreds of times. They seem to know about it. You know, it's they're advertising it. I have to think that all these people checked into the Roach Motel and they never checked out. Somebody would have said something.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
And that's hugely correct, Mike. Obviously, if we really think about it, there's no way they could get away with it because people would be just disappearing.
If it was the VR storyline, then it makes more sense.
Right.
At least to me.
There's also the question of, you know, at the end, the scientists and his guards are dead, but how many clones of other people are still in hibernation? You know, like, if those other people were rescued, were the clones rescued as well?
Or when they were done with the clones, did they? Or the people that were in hibernation, did they just, you know, throw them in the acid tanks? You know, I don't know. I mean, we don't know. And or maybe they wake them up and they go away and they didn't know anything bad happened, and they just get rid of the clones. You know, so they could have had a lot. Most of the people didn't have the experiences as the Swartz person that had her head cracked against a window, or what happened to Eve and Tom. Maybe most of them, it was they didn't know that they were cloned, and then after 30 days they were let go, and they just said, all right, we got 50,000, and that was easy. We don't know how the other experience went. We only know the one.
Well, right, that's what I'm asking, is like, so yeah. what exactly is going on? I mean, obviously, I'm guessing they're cloning everybody. You know, so yeah. the originals ever survive it? Are they all locked up in a tank somewhere? Or maybe were they both clones at the end?
Yeah, that's true. And that would solve all their problems, because the two clones, our memory is whatever they want, right?
Yeah.
So
I mean, because it was really convenient that, no, I just happened to get out at just the right time, dear. I'm really me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, how did he escape that quick? Right, that's a good point.
Well, not just that quick, but that. Well, I mean, it took him
almost
a month.
That
moment.
Yeah, that moment. Yeah.
So she got a false choice again, and it could have been a head game. So maybe she did shoot the right one, and not knowing that the other one was also an evil fucking clone.
Right, that's true. Assuming Eric's point, which is he was a psycho all along, which I still don't think. But also, is there multiple clones too for each of them?
Yeah, it just feels like the ending feels a little contrived to get to that ending. You know, they both have the stab wounds in the belly. Well, they saw when they saw that you stabbed him, they stabbed me too. It's just
right.
So again, for all we know, he's a clone too. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad idea. They want, because you could see this company is trying to do kind of a mind fuck with her. And, you know, as long as she goes out there and carries clone baby to term, I guess that's part of what they're experimenting. But it feels like the clone baby is a different experiment than the husband experiment.
I was going to say, if she's carrying, if birth is how the clones are made, how do we get a full grown Tom so quick?
Yeah, I don't know.
Just add water.
Right.
And it makes me wonder, like, did they...
Well, no, I think that might have been an additional experiment.
Yeah.
Like, in other words, they knew how to clone people as full-grown adults, but they were like, hey, let's see if we can, you know, get a woman pregnant with a clone and see how that would go. Like, I got the sense there were more experiments going on there than maybe we were privy to.
Yeah, I do wonder, well, first of all, I got to give credit to the clone because I would have gotten maybe two pages of baby names and stopped. I would have come out. He went all,
you know what?
He went all Jack Torrance with babies.
That's what I was going to say. That's the, I thought, what does they type in The Shining? All work and no play. I saw that. And like, all I thought of was The Shining. I was like, that is brilliant.
That out loud while we were watching the movie, Chrissy.
I mean, I got to figure he gets to like page 20. He's like, okay, so what are some Croatian names I can use? I don't.
Bill Belichick. Croatian American.
If your spouse is trying to write a book, approaching them every day and going, hey, how's the book coming along, isn't going to help your marriage.
But I do give her credit because, you know, a lot of writers, my understanding, with a couple of writers on this podcast, is that writers do sometimes get writer's block. And I don't think anyone ever just thought of the simple solution of saying, well, just don't have it anymore.
Right.
That's how you get rid of it.
I mean, obviously, a lot of these movies where they have writers and they're going to write the book or whatever, we all know that, you know, that's malarkey because you can write the book and it still doesn't mean it's going to sell. So obviously, they got to have a different profession than just a writer, unless they're already a famous writer. Also, another thing that was curious too was the ending when. The very last scenes, why they escape, but they never went to the police or something to explain what happened and what's going on. I don't know, you know. So it looks like
officer,
probably because
I cloned the husband,
half a dozen people. That might have something to do with it.
Well, I think they could prove otherwise, you know, that they're innocent. I mean, look at what's the terrible things that have been going on here, you know.
I'm hiring a genetically engineered baby of my husband's clone, who's not really my husband, but he was captured and cloned, and then I freed him.
Well, again, we don't know the outside world, right? I mean, if this was Westworld, it would be season one, and we don't know what's going on outside
right,
of Westworld. Right, so we don't know if clones are common or robots or whatever.
Oh, I think that I don't think they are because was
pretty
not
sure like this is possible. Meant to be pretty much this world.
Yeah, maybe like, you know, 20 minutes in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say
I did love the little opening image of two mirror landscapes.
Yes,
pretty cool.
Actually, what it reminded me of, because there was also Philadelphia, wasn't it? Was Devil?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
It had the opening shot of the inverted Philadelphia here they're doing a mirror, but I still think it was a really nice shot.
This was Philadelphia, Mike?
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Because that's where they had the premiere.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
I'm curious because the one actor in there.
According to IMDb, it was filmed in Philadelphia.
I'm wondering if the director lived in that area, because he's like the one name actor, so to speak, in the movie.
The director?
The director.
Chow.
Right. So because he's been in a ton of things. He's probably, I'm guessing, most famous for being Dr. Martin Candle from Lost. As like sort of the face of the Dharma Initiative.
That's where I knew him from. Okay.
Yeah.
But he has been in other things as well, you know, and some things recently, which I'm blanking on right now. But I did look at his IMDb, and he's been like in a ton of little TV. So he had an episode of The X-Files he had done. So he had done a lot of stuff. I mean, he's not. I mean, this isn't like getting Ed Asner for that other show. What was that other film where Ed Asner had the
Mom,
right? So, you know, so it's not like he's not on an Ed Asner level, you know, but for any indie film, just getting a guy that's like, oh, I've seen that guy somewhere before.
Exactly.
That's a huge coup.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so, yeah, who knows if he's from, that guy lives in Philadelphia or not. So for folks who are curious, because we never really set it up, basically there's a experiment going on where this director / doctor guy is bringing in married couples from the beginning, you know, when they're first married, all the way to 50-year anniversary type stuff. Basically, he says that he's doing an experiment on the one key ingredient that keeps marriages together. So from the honeymoon phase all the way to the 50th anniversary, what is the successful thing between the two and whatnot? And then they ask him, one of the people that are in the experiment during orientation says, what about you? Are you ever been married? And he says he was, and you know, his wife had passed. And whatnot. And so that's a little backstory for him. And then what happens is that the two people in the marriage, the husband and wife, they go off into different rooms to have further orientation and tests. And then after that, they're put into a house. And in that house, it looks like they can't leave the indoors. They're stuck indoors. But it's a fancy house, very modern, wealthy type house. So you know, you get anything and everything that you need. And if they last 30 days, they get the $50,000 and that's it. Our two leads are not actually married. They lied because they obviously wanted $50,000. However, they're close to marriage. They're, you know, in the honeymoon phase, the promissory ring, all that crap. So they're probably going to get married anyway, unless something happens. So though they lied, they are a couple, at least common law. And so what happens is what Eric mentioned and other people mentioned, is it really them being watched to try to figure out what makes a successful marriage / relationship, or are they trying, as Mike said, break them up to see what causes the differences in relationships to falter too? And then, of course, there's the sinister thing of
those things, and also trying to find, you know, where they went wrong. Because they're trying to find the genetic memories that, you know, best suit to create those lasting relationships. So when they find something wrong, they're like, okay, this is what went wrong here. This is what went wrong here. Okay, so we got to try something else with the next clone. But it's clear that they don't tend to stop when one thing goes wrong. They wait till the experiment's completely over before trying again. You know, they want to get every bit of data as they can, and it's clear that despite how he tries to sound sincere, I doubt the doctor really cares that much. I mean, considering if we, you know, take what happened in front of the front window of their house where the woman got her head smashed in, they're like, okay, well, just keep the cameras rolling. I'm sure it'll work itself out somehow. You know, they clearly don't seem to really care when all this shit seems to go down. Because the results matter to them most.
Yep. Now, what do you think of this, basically they have these holograph people that do orientation each day with a question, basically, to see how everything's going and whatnot. It's either the director guy or an assistant. And the assistant's a woman and the director's a guy. And then as the movie goes on, the woman starts wanting both of them. It's weird. She's wanting the woman, Eve, about her husband. And then we see her talking to the husband and discussing different things. And so I think that was the question is, and then eventually she gets fired or leaves the company. But I think that kind of intentionally confused the audience to make us wonder if that's part of the experiment that you're suggesting, Mike, which is to break them up to find flaws to cause the loss of trust in each of them. Or was she really warning them that, hey, there's something nefarious going on. You gotta watch out. But as us audience members, I was looking at it as what you were saying, Mike, which is she wasn't warning them, but she was trying to cause mischief to see how they would react.
That was at first that was it, and then once you got to the pregnancy thing, then it felt like there was more of an ulterior motive involved.
Yeah, okay. Makes sense. Let's see. Any other thoughts?
I kept wondering, you know, with the monarch butterflies, a little bit about that genetic accuracy of that thing, of what the doctor said. I didn't get a chance to look it up, so I was wondering if how true that was.
I'm not really sure where that comes from. You know, and why would that be different for a monarch butterfly than, you know, any other type of butterfly? I guess it has something to do with, like, its migration and remembering where to migrate. But, you know, I don't know that they mean that. And that sounds like the sort of thing, like, when they hear about in physics, so, you know, about dark matter, and suddenly it becomes, people, ooh, dark matter! And so there's suddenly this insidious force in the universe that every science fiction and horror thing uses to make things sound pseudoscientific, as, like, the origin of the Cenobites or something. And it has nothing to do with what dark matter and dark energy actually are. You know, so I think it's something like where they just hear scientists use a phrase like genetic memory and just kind of grab the ball and run with it, even though it has really nothing to do with what the actual phenomenon really is.
Because I was kept thinking back to certain points of the film. I was trying to see, you know, if there were like any sort of like hints to the butterflies. You know, but I didn't see that many of it. It felt like they were mostly just kept to the last few minutes of the film.
Right. So I'm looking right here in an article. It says, so the monarch butterfly migrates 4,000 kilometers. Oh, fucking kilometers. What communist bullshit is that? From Canada to Mexico during winter and then back during spring. Although this may seem a simple, like simple memory, the time it takes for them to leave Mexico spans over three generations, meaning no butterfly making the return trip to Canada has flown the route before, right? So it's a genetic memory, right? So it's, meaning it's an instinct passed down. So that's kind of what it's referring to. But I don't think it means like that, you know, the baby butterfly is getting its parents' memory of flying over Connecticut, you know, on its way to on its way to Canada. Okay. I think it's just that there is information passed on, but it's not I don't think it's like what we're talking about here. But I mean, it is just kind of let's take the ball and run with it because it's an interesting story idea.
Right.
And sort of like, you know, how they, you know, things get chaos theory wrong and other stuff. But
another thing they didn't answer in this movie is what would possess somebody to build a bookcase like that?
Well, I know why I would do it. And the reason I would do it is the same reason that when Pam gets up to go to the bathroom when I'm playing Trivial Pursuit, I shuffle the pieces around. It would be there to just fuck with people. And because I know somebody would walk into my house and they would never be able to not look at the bookshelf.
Right. Well, those bookshelf, that bookshelf obviously is more for trinkets and miscellaneous book here or there. It's not supposed to be like a, for a regular bookcase.
It's crooked and horribly inefficient.
Right.
I'm done.
It has to be for books because nothing else, right? Because you put the books on the shelf, they'll slide down and you can stack them up. It makes sense. If you put your, like, your little Alpine Boy doll, China doll on there and slides down,
well,
it won't
here's
be able
the
to
thing.
Stay where it's supposed to be.
I think that was a very interesting choice, actually, because it sort of works with the whole idea of single effect in that we're talking once again about skewed perceptions, right? She keeps saying, it's not Tom, it's not Tom. And even though he's a clone, he keeps noticing things about her that aren't right. So I think it really just is there to sort of reinforce how skewed this is. You know, we're really talking about differences in perception and things are off, you know?
So, I do wonder, when was Tom a clone?
Right. Yeah.
Was he a clone from the beginning? Did they swap him out in the middle of the night?
I don't think he was a clone at the beginning, because that first week and a half, when you get to see Chloe Carroll completely naked, they're happy. So, you know, they have that montage, not really a montage because there's a lot of speech and stuff during the music. But for no other better terminology, we'll call it a montage. That period, she was fine. She was happy. They were, you know, it was her Tom. It wasn't a clone Tom. So I'm guessing it must have happened overnight. Because all you have to do is gas. You know, they didn't show this, but if they did, then we would have known that something was fishy with the director/doctor right from the beginning of the movies, and they didn't want us to do that.
They decided at the beginning, though, didn't they? Because, I mean, they both go in, and they wake up in those, like, uniforms, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you did. Yeah. You're right, Eric. So, we already know that they've been knocked out unconscious. And not just knocked out unconscious. I even said this to my wife. I go, this is weird because people were able to see her naked and him naked when that's kind of gross when they were asleep.
Here's the other thing that caused me to ask a question to Dan during the movie, which was how at one point she goes into her suitcase to get the magic mushrooms?
LSD,
whatever it was. That caused it, okay. Yeah. So how is it they have their own suitcases with their own stuff in them, but they're wearing those fucking uniform.
Well,
that
I think
it makes sense.
I think it was like, remember the platform where they were allowed to bring one item? I think that was LSD. I think that they were told you were allowed to bring a suitcase.
Right.
And whatever you can squeeze in the suitcase, you can bring with you. You know,
well, I did agree with Eric though. If you're going to be gone for 30 days, you know, where was her sundresses and where was his golf shirts? You know, they didn't
or
have
jeans
it.
Jeans or whatever.
Yeah,
anything in that uniform.
Yeah, and it makes it even weirder because, you know, they have guidelines on what's permitted and not. The very fact they were willing to pretty much, you know, confine these people, you think they would check their bags and stuff for the drugs that they didn't want them to have.
Well, there were cookies.
If they're willing to take off their clothes and put on jumpsuits while they're asleep, you figure they would have looked in the suitcases. But you're right. Maybe they were hidden as cookies, so they got away with it.
Right. What I would say about the clothes is two things. Is I'll offer two hypotheticals here. One, I think just symbolically, it was just, again, to show you that this is all part of this experiment and they're creatures in a zoo, and it's just a constant reminder that they're sort of being controlled by the company. So I think it's just more – I think it was just done as more of a visual cue to the audience than anything else.
Right. It takes away their individual identities by having them in jumpsuits.
Mm-hmm. Right. But if you want an in-story rationale for it – and I'm not saying that the writer, director thought of this – but if you want one, I would say maybe that they have like sensors in them so they can keep an eye on their vitals.
Okay.
Yeah.
That because they're monitoring everything. I mean, they're watching them take a dump. That can't be a good thing.
Right. Right. But all you have to do is take them off. I mean, when they have the sex scenes, you know, they just take off their clothes, right? So they're
not
being monitored
anymore.
Well, yeah,
but it's still, but better to have some data than no data.
Yeah, that's fair. But I mean, still, I mean, even when they're just lounging around, they're not in shorts, pajamas, nighties, whatever. They're just in these jumpsuits. So,
I don't think they let him bring the nighties along.
Well, night shirts, whatever. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know.
Well,
no,
it's just one of those things that like we talk about this in other contexts a lot, which is it would have taken one short scene, right? At the beginning, like, you can bring a suitcase. Don't bother bringing any clothes because we'll supply clothes if we need you to wear those because they monitor your bodily functions, whatever.
Right.
And again, I mean, it's a scene like that might have been in there, and that got to me. You know, it's like I figured, right, they were allowed to bring. I think it's there. I think it's some of it.
I see your point, Mike, but Eric's not the only one that was questioning it. You know, my wife was, I was. I'm not sure about Chrissy or Abe, or Pam, but it is something that some of us audience members were questioning.
I don't know that something that demanded an answer either.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I was just bringing up as something I noticed.
Yep. And you know what? You can ask the director maybe next week.
Maybe.
Yeah.
He's gonna come along and be like, "All right, buddy, you've got some answering to do."
Right.
Number one, the fucking bookshelf. What the fuck?
What is wrong with you? Why would you put a bookshelf like that in a movie?
Well, I think Chrissy made a good point.
And we can ask the question about the clothes.
I think you made a good point, Chrissy, which is,
yeah.
Or I'll even expand on it, that obviously that bookcase was there intentionally because, you know, everything.
Oh, it totally was. Because if you notice the door. The door also had crooked panes of glass in it.
Oh yeah.
So the whole thing was set up, I believe, intentionally as a symbol of a skewed reality.
Oh yeah.
There's a theme,
aesthetically of illusion. You know.
Yeah. I'm not actually questioning the bookshelf. I just would never want it in my house. That's all.
Yeah. No, but we are going to have to ask him. That has to be question number one. We can ask the other stuff after we get to the major themes and the. What was the point of the experiment again? When you get through the like getting maybe a little bit of better insight into the back, into the reveals at the end.
Okay.
Right. I think we should certainly ask about things like that. But yeah, I think that's an interesting question, you know, and sometimes they're silly questions. And if you guys, if you guys are asking these questions, odds are other viewers are asking those questions too. I know I have listened to directors' commentaries on films, and they're all over with. I'm like, why didn't they ever mention this? That's right. Been driving me nuts. Why did they not address this? Why have they not told me why they did this? It was such an obvious thing in the film. Why are they not speaking of it? Sure, you know, sure. and sometimes it can be a little thing, sometimes major. The one I always think of was Game of Thrones. Remember the episode in Game of Thrones where Jaime and Cersei have sex on their son's corpse?
Yes, I do remember that.
I mean, that old cliche. and it caused a lot of controversy over was it or was it not rape. And that is the one episode in the entire box that they did not do a commentary track for.
Interesting.
Huh.
Right. Interesting. All right. Let's see, what else? The reason I felt this was way in the future and not just 20 minutes in the future, as we could imply, is because they even had that weird thing where stuff would go down the tube and pop up in the
kitchen. Like pretty much a replicator.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Again, I was kind of getting Lost vibes from that. In that, because it was all coming out with like the logo of the company.
Generic brand from.
Right. The Dharma Initiative milk, the Dharma Initiative orange juice. And I just assumed that they had a warehouse supply. I mean, pneumatic tubes aren't a new thing. That's actually fairly old technology. They just added the Dayglo lights to it. So I just assume they'd say, you know, it's like Alexa and they just have an automatic warehouse or somebody there says, you know, go grab the peaches and cream, go grab the little, you know, the little mini vodka bottles and let's send them one.
At one point during the movie, when stuff started getting messed up, she goes in the kitchen by that thing. And I just said out loud today, I went, vodka, 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 vodka.
But my question is, could you ask for Grey Goose vodka, or is it just going to be the commodity vodka?
No, it's probably going to be
Sherman Initiative vodka.
Yeah, because all of them say Millennial Project or whatever, which is interesting because that also suggests that they're giving them maybe some kind of drug or administering other things. I think there's open...
Yeah.
I don't think they really addressed that, but that was sort of my suspicion. I was kind of like, oh, I wonder if they're like, or giving them, well, because, you know, he's a clone too, right? So the clones have different needs. I don't know.
Well, I think it also is to make, kind of control their findings when they kind of interview them and stuff like that. Kind of get, you know, precise sort of answers or biological readings and stuff like that. Trying to make sure there isn't anything that could mess up what they're looking for. Because, yeah, I think one thing, Tom, is a faulty clone, or he could be a perfect clone, in that his body might have certain things that be maintained in order to keep him alive. Though we kind of learn later on, because there's kind of this time skip, at the end, that he seems to function mostly fine without any sort of special maintenance.
Right, right. My understanding would be that what you said earlier, Mike, which is the clone would be just a, you know, a 29-year younger version of Abe, but the brain experience aren't the same, so he's still not Abe if he's a clone. He's more like a twin.
Well, here's the thing, though. In those screens at the end of the movie, they're about memory mapping, right? That's the process that was going on in the room she wandered into. So I'm assuming they would have mapped his memory, and it would have been that, right?
You would think, but again,
he turns out to be different, and she notices, right? So the way he kissed was different. The way mm-hmm. he talked, his I guess behavioral issues,
right.
You know, where he gets angry easier, you know, and all these other things. While the earlier version of him, he kind of bended really easy and, you know, let her have a lot of say, if more say than him, like most good husbands should. If you want a happy wife, you get a happy wife. So it was only later, and that's when she started noticing. So, yeah, I don't know, Eric. That's a good question. But also, Abe, you do have a good point, though, which is these clones are almost immediate, right? It's not like they were bred from a baby to an adult, and if they were, it was fast forward. It wasn't because, you know, within a week or a day, they have a clone. So that may be what you're trying to say, Abe, which is because of that, maybe they need different food or different something.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one thing. There's also one thing I'm trying to recall, but come back to me later. I'm trying to get the thought. Damn.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. Sometimes you just gotta get the right words. What about you, Mike? Abe's point, which is if these clones are, I guess, almost, you know, only a week old, even though they're an adult male version. And then Eric's point, which is they're doing the memory link. Do you think?
I didn't remember now.
Yeah, go on.
Sorry. I think but it goes to your thing about the memory link. During the questionnaire, there are certain points where the doctors seem very wary of the answers they were getting. This kind of ties to a scene that happens later on where during the questionnaire, one of the doctors asked Tom if he was dominant or submissive when it came to intimacy. And he claims that he's dominant, but he seems he's trying to be sure that he's dominant, but he sounds kind of unsure. And that kind of goes that scene during one of the first sex scene at the house, where the clone of Tom is being rough with her, and she's shocked by this. So I think when they get this questionnaire, they try to map out the way that the subjects claim that their personalities are. So that's probably why sometimes when they do make the clones, the personalities come out different.
I understand where you're coming from on that, and I was wondering while the questionnaire was going on, I was like, they are lying their asses off, and this is going to come back to bite them. But at the same time, I don't think that really. I mean, I'm pretty sure I saw the exact words "memory mapping," right? And taking answers from a questionnaire is something different in my mind. So I understand your point about how what they said on the questionnaire was demonstrated later, but I don't know if it's related directly.
Yeah, I think too. Well, the key there was that the memory mapping, I think for his image, I can't remember if it said completed or not, but the 923 was their secret. So that's why when she was in the tub and she said to him 923, mm-hmm. that was their safe word. He had no idea what they were talking. He was like, what does that mean?
Right.
And so that was the signal to us as the audience that maybe he was a clone or maybe he wasn't or something was wrong with him. I thought this was very clever the way I could not figure out if he was losing his mind. I mean, I did not suspect he was a clone until we got toward the end, when they obviously give you that sort of information, but I could not figure out what the hell was going on with him. I'm like, that's why I thought there was like drugs in the food.
No,
because it's like maybe he forgot that or something because they drugged it out of him. I wasn't sure.
Christy, I think when I think of memory mapping, I kept thinking perhaps there's a certain part, the memories and stuff like that they had managed to copy were only to a certain extent until they got lost at the most recent, which is why he couldn't remember the date, 923. You know, he couldn't remember the most recent things.
Could be.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that safe word, too, Chris. I forgot about that. Yeah, that's a good point.
Did you understand that's not how safe words are supposed to work, right? That's
right. But
you would know better than me.
Yeah, I know
what you're talking about. With all those hookers you hire with the Patreon money.
There you go, Mike. But, yeah, the safe word was an ingenious way to... But again, though, why would they even think that? I mean, to even have that, because I would have gone in like dum de dum de dum and not even think there would be any nefarious thing going on. And then 30 days later, I have 50,000. So they obviously felt something was going to be fishy or something. I don't know. What else? Anything else anybody wanted to bring up that we're missing?
I'm still not convinced that Tom wasn't a psycho. Because even if it was the clone at the end, I don't know.
Because
they kind of ran into this. They weren't actually planning on getting married right away, but they went into this to get the $50,000. So I got the feeling they didn't really know each other that well to begin with.
Right.
Because
I don't know.
Did it say how long they'd been together? Was it like, I got the impression that they'd only been together like a month.
I don't know.
Just made that up in my head or if they said it in the movie.
I don't know. Yeah, but Mike or Chris or Abe, did you guys catch that? How long were they together before the movie starts, right?
Long enough that they're going to get married, but not long enough to get married. So anywhere from 2 weeks to 12 years, that would be my guess.
The way that the doctor reacted when he interviewed him first, he seemed really hesitant to even put him on there because he felt that their marriage would be most likely to fail. Like, it was very young and very inexperienced. Like, they were just too early. It was too early for them.
Yeah, I got the impression that it was a young relationship and that they were still indeed in the honeymoon phase of a new relationship and that they were totally into each other but hadn't known each other for that long. That was my impression. Again, I'm not 100% sure if it was said somewhere in the movie or if I'm just making it up in my head.
Right. Let's see. Anything else that we want to bring up? Oddly, I thought there would be a lot more symbolism stuff that we could figure out, but...
That's on Chrissy. That's her job. She knows that.
You have one job, Chrissy.
And we have to rely on Eric to figure out the whole fucking bookshelf.
I'm slacking. Well, no, I just think I want to give this movie a second watch. So if we do get the filmmaker on, I'll have a little more time to have sort of read and prepared some good questions. Because I do have a lot of questions about like the drugging of the food and the... I mean, the whole idea, too, that it takes place at Christmas. I know that Phil had sort of mentioned, you know, that adds nice atmosphere and everything to it.
That was Mike.
But I think it's interesting that Christmas as a holiday is a choice. Because, you know, in a typical film...
Well, the virgin birth thing. But...
It's the virgin birth thing. It's got the whole business about lights going on, the purity of gift giving, in that, you know, each other is a gift, you know, like you're a gift to the other person, to the other person's life, but now this gift is sort of getting tainted. There's a lot of interesting associations there. You know, the fact that Christmas is the Christmas tree, even though it may be fake, is an evergreen, you know, but that was interesting too. was it actually Christmas? Like, why did they bring their Christmas
shit?
Who
the hell knows?
That just seemed very weird to me. Like, I was like, that's why I was kind of like, there's got to be some kind of symbolic
you
connection
can't
with that.
Believe anything you saw in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, virtual reality thing too. I mean, that's what you guys thought right off the bat, you know. And I didn't even.
I wonder if you could go up to the machine and ask for Christmas, Halloween decorations instead in protest.
Well, what was that movie by the guy that did Sleepy Hollow and all that? Night Before Christmas. So there you go.
Yeah.
Anything else anybody want to bring up? Anything?
So that bookshelf.
Anyway.
What does it mean?
All right. I guess we can move on. All right. So we are here with filmmakers, performers, combination of both. And we were lucky enough to get a hold of you folks because co-host Mike actually met, at least he only remembers Chloe, but I guess he met maybe both Chloe and Phil. But why don't we introduce yourself? So let's start with you, I guess the director. Why don't you start?
Hi, my name is Philip Carroll, and I'm the director of The Honeymoon Phase, my first feature film.
And the person sitting next to him.
Hi, I'm Chloe Carroll, and I produced and star in The Honeymoon Phase.
And the last guest.
Hi, my name is Jim Shubin, and I just starred in the film.
Slacker.
Very well, very well. Basically, Honeymoon Phase popped up on iTunes and various other formats recently. Co-host Eric noticed it, brought it up as a possible topic. None of us had seen it, so we're going to go in blind. And then Mike mentioned that he had met some of you folks at a Poconos, film festival. And so he said, let's do that one. And so we all agreed, and we were all pleasantly surprised with the film. So we have a lot of questions. I know Chrissy and a lot of us were saying, oh, it would be great to have the filmmakers on so we could ask and ask Jim and Chloe and whatnot, what, you know, their thoughts about certain scenes and stuff. Let's go in. We usually do alphabetical order by first name. So, Eric, why don't you ask the first question?
Oh, okay. This is just kind of a weird thing that occurred to me while I was looking at the IMDb page today. Which is that the release date on this was August 21st. We're recording this at the end of September. There's been a pandemic going on for the last 6 months. So did your filming run up against that at all, or was it done before all that occurred?
No, thankfully, we were done filming way before the pandemic hit. We actually shot in January and February of 2018.
Okay.
It's pretty old at this point, I guess, that we shot it. Post was from February to October of that year. And then there's pretty much a year-long waiting process to hear back from film festivals and everything like that, of where we were in kind of the yearly schedule of film festivals. So thankfully, we avoided all of the turmoil that's happening right now.
Okay, cool.
Very good. All right, Chrissy, why don't you go?
My first question actually is one of the themes in this movie, I think, is the shifting of perception, and how they want us to get a feeling that things are skewed. And so I know that on our podcast, when we actually talked about the show or the film last week, we had talked about some of the elements in the set that kind of related to that. And I know that's why Eric's laughing. So, because we really want to know about what types of things you put in the set besides just like we noticed the bookcase was kind of skewed and that the door, the clear door there had kind of the angles. Were there any other things in the set or any other things that you guys kind of did to sort of beef up that theme?
That's a great question. There are other things in there, actually. The way that the mediator opens is kind of like on an angle when it comes up, that the projector device, the butterflies in Tom's office that are on the wall, it's in like a skewed pattern up the wall. So it's funny you pick that stuff out. But yeah, that was definitely a theme we were going for. And when we found that house location that had some of those elements already in there, like the bookcase and the door, it was like a jackpot for production design, you know, with Tom being the writer and with him being, you know, hiding who he really is, and the idea of him as an author hiding this deep secret within that, the bookcase kind of came to play in that too. So I'm glad you picked those elements out.
Yeah, it was really cool. I think, I think the only reason I picked up on it is because a lot of times when a relationship changes, it's really just because a perception changes. Either your perception of the other person or your perception of what you thought your life with that person was going to be, and then it totally goes in a different direction. And so I think that's probably the only reason why I noticed that stuff. But yeah, I just wanted to ask about that because I was like, I'm sure there's more stuff that they put in there and I just didn't pick up on it. Because sometimes if you only watch a film once, you don't get it all in one sitting. You know, you have to really kind of study it if you're looking for things.
We tried in the camera work too to kind of go along with that idea of changing perception with like some of the shots literally like turning, like her world is turning upside down with, you know, this as her relationship is falling apart. That was kind of a motif that we had, the camera turns.
Today when I was rewatching before this, I noticed the one shot where you kind of zoom out on the hallway and then go back down while turning the camera. That's really cool.
Yes. that was another one. Because I think when you are in a relationship, you're only viewing it from your own perspective. So you're missing an entirely different perspective, which is the other person in that relationship. And that was one of the things that I tried to explore in the writing and also in the film itself, where Tom is telling the story of his relationship with Eve, but then we're seeing it from Eve's perspective. So it's like these two competing narratives based on, you know, who's telling the story. So I'm glad the production design and the camera work also, you know, went along with that idea, I guess, of shifting perspectives.
All right, Mike, what do you got?
All right, well, since our literary expert went all symbolic and crap on us, let me as a science person here go into that. I was interested. You brought up the inspiration for the story. You bring up the monarch butterfly and genetic memory. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the story was inspired by pretty much just me and Chloe wanting to jumpstart our careers by doing a feature film and being newlyweds ourselves. You know, I think when you're making a horror movie, you're always drawing from your own fears. So we want to explore the anxieties of being in a relationship and being young lovers and you know, early on in your relationship, you hope you're making the right decisions and you hope the person doesn't change into something that is like Clone Tom.
We always like to preface this with like we're in a very healthy marriage. This film has nothing to do with our own marriage because people are like,
yeah,
kind of read into that. Yeah,
you guys personally, and it nothing on this point.
Yes, no, we're happily married, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're happily married because you explore those things in film, and then you come home at the end of the day, and you know, you live the happy side of that.
Yeah, so. Phil writes all of his anger into his stories.
No, not anger, fears. I'm not an angry person. But yeah, no, I mean that's where that came from. And Jim, I know you want to jump in here.
No, I was just talking with a couple of friends who saw the film the other day, and they asked about that exact thing. They're like, how do you go to that place? Is it hard to go to dark, weird places? I said, no, when I'm driving my car and someone cuts me off, I'm a dark, angry person. But when I'm on set, I get to be a dark, angry person, and it's great.
Yeah.
That's exactly the same thing. Like, you just get to let it out, and then you come home, and you're like, I feel so good now.
I think some of our actual couples' arguments are probably in that film somewhere, some of the debates that we've had. But then the monarch butterflies, going back to that aspect, I wanted to ground some of the sci-fi elements of the movie into some sort of, you know, actual science. And I guess I'll do a spoiler warning here, and then you can edit this and put it where you want. But for the monarch butterflies, they actually, the theory is scientifically that they have genetic memory, and that's how they know their migration patterns. So with the memory mapping in the film, we wanted to have some sort of science basis for that. So they were you know, using the same techniques that monarch butterflies use in their genetic code to then map memories of human beings. And I think also just a quick jump in too. I said clone Tom in the previous thing. So if you just want to make an edit note to just cut out the word clone until we get to the spoiler section.
I'll just make the spoiler section now.
Yeah, that's fine too.
I'm so bad at not saying spoilers.
I meant to say the multifaceted personality of Tom is very complicated.
They already know now. You told the audience.
He feels like a clone
sometimes. Yeah.
Like a clone.
I know, obviously, Chloe and Phil, you guys were married and you decided to make a film together. So we know how you folks got involved. But how did you guys, or I should ask, maybe I ask Jim directly. Jim, how did you get involved? And because obviously you were a find for these folks to get, you know, to do the part, because your part had to have different nuance, because we're in the spoilers, you're a clone, so at one point you're a different personality than prior.
Thank you, I appreciate that. I did a commercial with Phil and Chloe in 2017 down in oh my God, where was that?
Yeah, we were in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
We were in Lancaster, that's right, it was a 2-hour drive that morning.
Yeah,
we were in
a dental commercial.
We did a dental commercial, and I played a groom. And then, I don't know, 6 months later, I saw Chloe was filming something, so I reached out and said, hey, you're looking for a guy? I'd love to be that guy. She said, you know, we can't pay. I was like, I don't really care. Let's just do something. It'll be fun to work with you guys again. And then that kind of turned into a soft audition because they were planning to do the film. And we'd already had a nice repartee, and we were friends, and I came in for the callback after filming an audition. I was on vacation with my family in Colorado and when I got the audition. So it's funny, I have this beautiful wall that we did in our house for filming auditions. And I was at my parents' house in Colorado and I had to throw up a sheet and try to film an audition real quick in the middle of my 3-day vacation for the film. And came in for the callback, and it was just an absolute blast to see them and work with them again. And it was a slow build of a relationship, and it was great. And I think that's kind of what this business is more than people realize. It's all about sticking with people you want to work with all the time.
Makes sense. Yeah. I mean, you always see famous directors work with the same actors over and over because they have that relationship, so yeah, it makes sense.
Bill.
Jim, I'm hoping we can have a long-lasting friendship and collaboration relationship, so don't you worry.
All right, Eric, what do you got?
Okay, this is going to be a weird one, so I'm gonna set it up first. And there are a couple of sex scenes between Chloe and Jim in this movie. Mm-hmm. And in hearing other interviews with actors, just about any time I've heard actors interviewed about doing sex scenes, they say it's not very sexy at all. It's really kind of awkward. There's just a bunch of people standing around with microphones and cameras and lights. I was wondering if the fact that one of you is married to the director made it more or less awkward, and if everybody has the same answer.
I know, Jim, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, it was really nice to have my husband there with me.
That's awesome.
Oh, is that not the question?
Jim, I love that answer. That's great. Yeah, I mean, it's really what it was. I mean, I saw it more as I was your father. So, like, I think that's more...
Just to make it a bit weirder.
Yeah, I was coaching you.
Way more messed up. I'm glad I didn't know that at the time.
No, but I was just wondering if it was something that crossed your mind or whether it wasn't a factor or if it had any role in the dynamic of the situation.
Not for me, because honestly, when you've got four men all holding cameras around you and someone shining a light in the lady's face so that in Chloe's face so that it gets the proper, you know, glow of the moment, and they're like, okay, so grab her hair, and you go, okay, grab her hair, and they're like, no, lower your arm. You're like, I can't hold her. Just make it work. And you're like, okay. But my neck doesn't work this way. Like, okay, but now make it sexy. And you're like, yeah, this isn't sexy at all.
Right.
This isn't weird. It's not weird at all. So, no, we would always laugh at the end of takes, which was
That's
nice.
Great. That's great.
Yeah. It was always just really, well, that was weird. And I'm glad we've moved on from this moment. Let's do a fun scene now.
A fun one where you're strangling me.
Where I can put some clothes on. That'd be great.
It's just like, you just feel like stupid because, like, on my close-ups, especially in the
rough scene.
The rough scene. That's a nice way to describe that one. Like, on my close-ups, I was like, you know, can someone rock me? Because I can't get the right timing. And it's
the rhythm.
Yeah, like, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just, like, shaking myself.
I mean, that had to be hard. I don't even know if we ever talked about that, but that had to be hard for you guys to match rhythm without really touching, you know? Like, I can't imagine what that's
Jim's
like.
Jim's like this, just...
It's like,
while a bunch of random people just watch you, pretend to, like, be into it while nothing's happening.
Oh, you know, the weirdest thing I've ever... And this was the weirdest direction I've been, like, okay. And then, obviously, you have an orgasm, and then you're done. Like, so pretend to have an orgasm. All right. So, how do I do that?
I don't know. Great. How do you do that?
I don't know. I don't know what my face looks like. I know what my face looks like when I'm angry, but
Jim, in preparation, you didn't film yourself, you know, to get your facial reactions
just
correct?
A GoPro while you're like...
And I requested that be cut from the interview. I'm kidding. No, I did not film myself, you weirdo. No, I didn't. I just hoped that the moment would work.
Everyone's going to go back and rewatch it now to see if they believe Jim. Just to, like, pause it on the O face.
For the marketing of the film, we did a bunch of stills for, like, potential posters, and I had Jim and Chloe both do a bunch of O faces, kind of like, what's that film?
Nymphomaniac.
Their posters were all the actors doing O faces, and we had no idea what we were doing for the marketing at that point, so I was like, let's just get it.
It's like, Phil, we're never going to use that. He's like, do it!
Oh, no. The best part is my wife was there for this photo shoot.
Was she?
And at one point, she was like, no.
That's not what you look like.
No, I was like, all right, well, you want to come over here and help me then? Because I don't know.
As women, we never tell men what they look like when they orgasm.
That's probably best.
Well,
we don't want to know.
We don't want
to
know.
No, I can definitely attest to that. That it's not something that you tell a guy.
But if you know, your face gets all scrunchy at a point.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a whole thing.
Yeah, it's a whole big thing.
Eric, you ruined
it. I'm
so
glad that there's a woman on this podcast for Chloe to also relate to here. So many times it's just a bunch of dudes. So this is good. We get a female perspective here on this scene.
Yeah. Well, yeah. In fairness, she is the most manly person on the podcast. So. What?
I'm on my best behavior tonight. Let's put it that way.
There's no need.
I appreciate it.
Chrissy, you got a question?
I do, actually. The opening line of this film, which is, you know, my wife committed suicide on our wedding day, is just absolutely killer. It's like the perfect opening for like a short story or a novel. And then the conflict is very tightly presented and it spindles out pretty quickly. It struck me as being very like Poe-esque in terms of like, did you hear all that? Cause I just didn't realize.
Yeah, you're much better now.
Yeah, it struck me as being very Poe-esque because it really relies on the unreliable narrator. So I was kind of wondering how much of the unreliable narrator technique were you consciously using when you were writing this film? Or was it just something that sort of happened? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was definitely a technique that I wanted to use throughout because Tom is kind of constantly telling his version of the story in a way to mislead the audience into thinking that, you know, Eve was the one that had a breakdown. And that's kind of part of the fun of the movie too, I think, is where you're trying to decipher, you know, who's telling the truth, which version of this is accurate, is Eve crazy or is Tom really changing? And, you know, the unreliable narrator was a really great tool in helping to convince the audience one thing or the other. You know, it was, I think, seeing reviews of the film, it's been really interesting because it is kind of a divisive thing where some people like that Tom says that, you know, his wife commits suicide on their wedding day, where some other people view that more as like, oh, it's a tension deflator. You know, I know the ending. But I think part of the fun of it is you think you know the ending, but then when it gets to the ending, you're like, oh, my gosh, no, that's not quite true. You know, like what he said, it doesn't fully add up into what actually happens. So I'm glad that you enjoyed that technique.
No, I really do. I'm a big fan of it, and I use it in a lot of my own work. And I think this film was particularly well done in that it, as somebody, I just actually gave a classroom lecture on the unreliable narrator too, so it's fresh in my mind. But as somebody who reads a lot of that, one of the things I really loved about this movie was that I could not decide. I was sitting there going, okay, is she crazy? Or is it, or is like you said, or is Tom really changing? And I was going back and forth. And I think that's a sign that it's really well done, that you can't really make up your mind, at least until the end.
Yes.
And even at the end, there's a little bit of a question there because you're sort of not sure. And I just liked that. So I just wanted to ask about it.
Yeah, no, thank you very much.
I was just going to say
some of that. Oh, yeah, go on there.
I was just going to say, Chrissy, I would recommend giving the movie a second watch because I did that today. And there's a lot of stuff in there that you might miss the first time. I know I did. I missed it the first time. And well, so I'm just going through it again today. I was like, oh, there's a clue. Oh, there's a clue.
Yeah, well, when we had watched it last week, I rented it. But I'm just going to buy it now so I have it.
Oh, you know,
yeah, they've got like deleted scenes and bloopers and all that kind of thing. It's pretty awesome.
Because once I really fall in love with the movie, then I just end up buying it. But I like wasn't like I was like, OK, but I don't get paid till Friday. So I'll just have to wait till Friday so I could buy the thing and then I'll enjoy it all the time.
Do end up buying it, buy the Apple version, if you can, the iTunes, because that's the one that has all the bonus features, the deleted scenes. There's an alternate ending. I'll show you.
Why did you not keep that one?
Our DVDs come out tomorrow, actually, so I'll show you.
Oh, no way, really?
Yes, yeah, they'll be in Walmart, Target, so they come out tomorrow.
Phil's going to get me up at like 6 a.m. to go to Walmart, which is an hour away, to go see if the DVDs.
Jim, yours will be in the mail, don't worry.
Thank you. I was going to say, I'm going to go to Walmart, but I feel weird buying my own movie.
Well, you want to do is just stand in front of the rack and take pictures of it.
100% doing that.
Just like point to yourself on the case.
Yeah, so just keep on saying, that's me. Everybody that walks by, that's me. You want to watch the movie I'm in? Hey, you want to buy this movie? I'm in it. Buy this movie. Watch my O face. You can see my O face.
Do you have Verizon? Yeah, I have Verizon. Have you seen my face? Yeah, I see your face. It's fine.
You've got to bring the DVD up to customer service and see if they'll just let you have it. Just be like, look, that's me on the cover.
Oh, my God. That would be so funny.
I'll turn it around mid the abortion scene and be like, that's me. If I get away with the scene, if I get kicked out.
That's great.
Which is literally, that is the picture they used. I don't know if you can see. They used like the picture of me with a curling iron.
Yeah. Oh no!
Oh, God. Oh, yeah.
By the way, why a curling iron? Because it was a nice 3-beat there. We see it at the beginning, then we see it when she throws it in the trash and she gets it for Christmas and tosses it away. And then we see it when she's committing the abortion or trying to. Why a curling iron? Or was that just random? Like, is there a specific... I'm totally just wondering. I'm not, like... I'm just curious.
So with it being a horror film, we wanted there to be some horror in it. And we thought a curling iron was kind of a unique device to try and do that with. And also from a story perspective, I thought it was very poetic that she was using something that Tom gifted her to beautify herself for him as a way to take back her body. So that's kind of where that came from the story perspective.
That's cool. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in there. I just figured since we were on the topic, I might as well ask.
No, great question.
Does the DVD have any of the special features as well?
Yes, all the same ones. So they're in HD on iTunes, and then they're in standard def on the DVD. It's all the same special features.
Oh, good. I'm going to get the DVD then.
Is there a Blu-ray too, or is it just going to be the DVD at this time?
Just a DVD at this time, but if the demand's there for it, then they said they would be open to putting out a DVD or a Blu-ray. So we're hoping.
We'll see what we can do for you.
Thank you.
All right, Mike, what do you got?
Okay, so we touched on the curling iron. What about the other Christmas gift, After Sunset? So is there a reason for that particular? Is there something you could shed light on?
So with the the idea of Tom changing into something else, we thought just kind of a werewolf cover would be kind of a fun little nod to the fact that he had changed. I just told our production designer, run with that idea and just make a fake movie cover. And that's what he came up with. And the names on there actually are two of our crew members starring in it.
Nice.
But yeah, unfortunately, it's not a real film that you can check out anywhere.
Well, now I'm disappointed.
Now, I have a question about the scene where they had, I guess not intruders, but people come to the front windows and... the Eve character, obviously saw something, yet the doctor or director said otherwise. And then, of course, Tom's the character said he didn't see anything either. The debate we were having when we were talking about the film was curious whether or not, prior to the ending, obviously, whether or not Tom actually saw something or the cloning process on him give him select things to see, to do, to think. And we were kind of curious on that because we weren't sure if he was actually part of the plan or not. You know, he went in where they told him this is what's happening.
Okay. Jim, you want to take that one?
I mean, from an actor's perspective, Tom was so well hidden that he didn't hear her screaming for a few minutes. And when he showed up, there literally wasn't anything. That clone Tom didn't see it happening, didn't see it coming. And when he got there, she was freaking out. He's aware he's a part of an experiment, obviously, and he knows that he's a part of this thing. So the possibility of something like that happening is possible. But no, I don't. I definitely don't think he saw anything. I don't know what the actual script idea behind that was, but that's exactly where we took it in terms of direction.
Yeah, and touching upon the clone Tom thing a little bit more, he is aware that he is a clone. That was something that we talked about. So he's constantly also trying to be somebody that he's not. He's trying to act, put on the show for Eve, kind of in a way to make her love him. You know, he's trying to be this man that he thinks that she wants, no matter what he does. You know, she's just not feeling the same way about him as he is about her.
But also someone he kind of is, and that's where the problem comes in.
Yes.
He's not Tom, he's just not Tom.
All right, now, to segue on to that. Eric, when we were talking, kept on wondering if Tom was always a violent person or sociopath or whatever, or was it because he was a clone at that point? And we were debating that too. And so we were curious. I said that he was a nice guy prior to the clone, and the clone just was, you know, loopy. And Eric said he wasn't sure. And we were curious if you could clarify that.
I love that that's been a debate that's been coming up. I think that's really fun because you guys aren't the first ones to kind of have that conversation where, you know, some people think that the ultimate thesis of the movie is that it was always in Tom's nature, you know, like he could have ultimately went down that path with, you know, becoming obsessed with wanting a child and, you know, the condom popping and all of that. Condom popping, that's a good way to put it. But yeah, you know, I don't think when we filmed it, we didn't dive too much into if real Tom had that potential. Because it, you know, I guess from me and Jim's, you know, perspective in our relationship as the actor director, it didn't really matter because Tom was gone at that point. So I think it would have clouded the direction in terms of us building this clone Tom character. But I like that it's become kind of this debate now that the film is out. It's unexpected. Jim, I don't know if you have anything to add. But.
I was chatting with my friends the other week and they asked about this and Tom is not, for me, Tom was never an overtly violent person. I don't think clone Tom is, but I think clone Tom is being forced into a situation where it's life or death. And so subsequently, and Phil, the big conversation we had about clone Tom was that he's only a month old. His cloning process was rapidly expedited in order to get him to a point where he's a full-grown adult and able to mimic being an adult. So his actual lifespan is only a month with memories of 20-plus years in his head that don't correlate to the way his body moves or feels or thinks. So he's childlike in nature, and I have a 15-month-old, and I can tell you that they are just violent in nature. And that the kids are, and that was a big part of a conversation, and the way we wanted Tom to kind of feel and come across the more the film went on is that he is sort of a child with an adult memories, and he doesn't quite know how to handle them. And when children don't get what they want, they lash out, whether they yell or they hit things or they throw things or they break something or they cry. And that's exactly what Tom does when something doesn't work out the way he wants. Clone Tom, he reacts in that way. And our hope was that in some way that would give an indication of this, the feeling of a difference of not quite a human being, but someone who is trying to be a human being.
Yeah, and I think that that also goes to the core, one of the core metaphors of the movie for, you know, domestic abuse, where we discussed how, you know, men, when they're in a relationship with a woman that's unhealthy, a lot of times they act like children. You know, they're like, why don't you like me? You know, why don't you love me? And very, you know, it can turn into that kind of violent childlike thing where it's like, okay, you're not giving me what I want, so I'm going to lash out. So Clone Tom was kind of that, the metaphor for that real life situation as well.
Yeah.
Something I never thought about until you just mentioned it was the fact that this is life or death for Clone Tom. It is. I never thought about it during the movie. Because if he is proven to be an inaccurate clone, then he'll be destroyed. Mm-hmm. And I guess he's aware of that.
Yes,
that's a bummer.
go check out the deleted scenes because that was a huge part of the way we thought about his process and how the whole white room scene and all those kind of.
Yeah, I saw the alternate ending.
Yeah, that gives, for me, that was the ultimate driver for the entire movie, is that alternate ending.
That's really interesting. I also, Jim, really, really liked the way you played the moments when he does get angry, as if it seems like he actually can't control it. Like it's just coming out of him, not voluntarily. I really enjoyed that aspect of your performance.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And I had another question, but now I can't remember what it is because I got so interested in what you were talking about. let's move on to Chrissy for now.
I just wanted to ask why you chose Christmas as the holiday. What significance does that have, if at all? Because, you know, you could have chosen Valentine's Day, you know, or Easter, which have kind of would have tied into the idea of new birth or new whatever, or Halloween because of the death of a soul. I just think it's interesting that it was Christmas. Why?
Like, interesting you chose the wrong season.
I thought it actually added a really interesting touch to it, but symbolically I was having trouble figuring it out. So I wrote that down as one of my questions.
Yeah, no, great question. So I love when horror movies can mix in those joyous holidays like Christmas. You know, Gremlins is a classic Christmas one.
Oh, yeah. Krampus. Yep.
You know, I love that because Christmas music's so cheery. You know, you look forward to that season. And then when you throw blood and guts onto it, it's just a great combination. It's a great juxtaposition of two things. But from a thematic perspective, you know, with this idea that Tom is a child, you know, Christmas is the ultimate children's holiday. So we really wanted to tie that into, you know, it's baby Tom's first Christmas, you know?
No, it was just really cool. I really liked it. And I love also the whole idea where she's like, do you want your present? And of course it's like sex and then it kind of goes south. So to me, that's also a parallel for like a lot of crappy holidays. Like when you're in a toxic relationship or your home life is not all it's cracked up to be, even a joyous holiday can just kind of turn to crap. Basically. Yeah. And I did pick up on that and I liked that, but I was like, there's gotta be something I'm missing here. So thank you for explaining that. Cause I just couldn't figure it out.
Sure,
and
yeah,
I was very excited when you guys were going to come on. Cause I was like, oh yeah, I'll get my answer.
No, thank you.
I don't have to think about it anymore. I could just ask.
That was one of the most fun things to shoot with some of those Christmas moments, because Tom is just reveling in the Christmas spirit with, you know, humming the Jingle Bells and Silent Night. And oh my God, that was the creepiest like ADR that we've ever done, where we had the whole crew get quiet. And then just Jim goes up to the microphone and starts humming these Christmas tunes. It is, we joke that around Christmas time, we want to release, you know, Tom's Christmas jingles, you know, on as a single.
Bill, please do this. I will record. I built a sound booth in my closet. We can do this.
There we go. We're working on the soundtrack release right now, so maybe we'll get you just humming as one of the tracks, Jim.
That would have been a great extra for the disc.
Yeah.
But speaking of the Christmas scene, check out the extras and the deleted scenes, because that Christmas scene is a one long shot. We spent an entire, what was it, like 6 hours trying to get that one shot, and we did like 25 takes of this scene that is one shot for like a 2-minute scene, and it is my favorite scene in the entire movie, and we cut half of it.
So Phil, you're like Stanley Kubrick forcing him to do 25 takes? Come on. What's up with that?
I am forcing, they just didn't get it right.
Oh,
wow. That's harsh.
And turns off camera.
No, when you're doing the long takes, there's so much that comes into it. I mean, Jim and Chloe, they're absolutely, you know, stars with their performances. But you have to time everything right. You know, they have to say lines on certain beats with the camera movements. And, you know, there's literally crew members moving furniture behind the scenes in that scene during the kiss. Because there's a couch there, and they were literally like wheeling in the couch off camera. So I let Jim and Chloe off the hook on that. They weren't the reason we did 12 takes of it. There's a lot of things that go into it.
It was such a fun night, though. That was the coolest scene.
What?
I mean, it was every time we like did a take, though, the whole crew rushed in to watch it.
Yeah, hoping it was the one.
Yeah, like, oh my God, please, this be the one, because no one did the whole thing.
Especially our poor cameraman.
Oh, Yanni, yeah.
The Steadicam that he had on is just like massive, and he's this like huge, muscly guy. Like,
he looks like a bodybuilder.
Yeah, and he's got the Steadicam on. The sweat's just pouring down from his face, and he's like, "This is the last take, Phil." And Phil's like, "Let's do two more."
That was like the quote of the shoot. Let's do two more. Yeah. Two more.
Just do 12 more, just for safety.
Well, it's because I get one and you guys get one. That's how it works, you know?
Yeah, but you can't say that two takes later. Like, that's not...
It's kind of like eating potato chips. Just two more. Just two more.
Just two more.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Speaking of Mike, why don't you ask a question, sir?
All right, so first of all, you already asked the next question I was going to answer, the question I was going to ask, which was whether Tom knew he was a clone or not. So that's mm-hmm. already been answered.
Yep.
But let me ask you both, and I think both of you give fantastic performances in this. I really do. And I think I'm going to, we do our little awards thing at the end of the year. We just name off and I always do, one of them is, you know, performances to savor. And I definitely think both of you are going in my performances to savor category. So I thought you were really phenomenal, but you both go through such a range of emotion from beginning to end in this. So first of all, I mean, were you filming this in sequence to help you with that mental state? Were you out of sequence, which I imagine would be nightmarish? How exactly does one prepare for a curling iron in the vagina? I mean, forget the O face. That's a completely different face. So how do you prepare for like all that whole emotional range and putting yourself in that mind frame that day?
With the curling iron scene, I'm actually method, so I did it.
Well, tell them about actually how that's kind of partially true with what happened a month before.
Oh my God, don't say it like that. I actually a month before we started filming, I had a really bad accident where I spilled a large McDonald's tea on my crotch and my legs in the car, and I couldn't get it off quick enough, and I had some really bad second degree burns all down my leg, and I was like, obviously, like, it was awful because I was like, oh my God, like, we're shooting a film in a month and I'm aware that there's like nudity and stuff, and I'm like, I look like fucking Freddy Krueger, sorry if I can't talk, sorry I swore. But I was like, at least when I was like taking all my Percocets, I was like, at least I know how it feels for Eve when she does that scene.
That inspiration.
Yeah. So I just totally method.
It's an authentic reaction in there.
Unfortunately for me.
I have a question about the time period, because what we were debating, was it like a few seconds in the future or like 10 years in the future? And I felt that it was probably like 10 years in the future, because you had the cool thing where you could ask for vodka and you know, all that stuff starts popping through. But then Mike comes up, he goes, yeah, but those things you see all the time, you know, that's old school now, you know, it's whatever. But we were just curious where it took time frame it took place, because, and I actually compared it to like Westworld, where that TV show where you didn't know what time period it was until they actually left the park, and so what do we got here? What's that answer to that?
Oh, I'm a big Westworld fan. I'm glad you thought of that. But yeah, we always talked about it as kind of like very near future, Black Mirror-ish, you know, first half of the 2020s. You know, that's because the technology that they have in their personal life, it's, you know, iPhones and old MacBook Pros and stuff. And we tried to give them models that were a couple years old to establish that they weren't having the newest stuff in their personal life because they were poor. But then when they go to this dream house, it is kind of futuristic tech. So it's very near future is what we were going for with it.
All right. So Mike, you were right. You were right. Eric, you got a question?
I do. A lot of filmmakers end up doing a genre film as their first film because of budgetary reasons.
horror movies can be done relatively cheaply compared to some others. And I was wondering if that was part of the motivation here or whether you have a passion for genre work and will be doing more in the future.
So we wanted to write a film that we could shoot for a low budget because before we had gone into production, our assumption was we were going to be doing a Kickstarter for it, plus whatever money we had saved up, and that would be what the budget was. Now, we were lucky enough to bring on a financier who produced the project, so we didn't have to go the Kickstarter route, but it was still an ultra-low budget production. I love genre films just as much as I love, you know, a typical drama. For me, it's always about what the heart of the story is, and if it's a good story, then I'm drawn to it. So I hope to continue to dabble in, you know, genre films as well. I joke with Chloe, but it's not really a joke. I'm hoping that this is like a Black Mirror audition. I'd love to direct an episode of Black Mirror or Westworld, you know, as you guys are talking about. I love that sci-fi horror, you know, tone.
Okay, I joke with Chloe, but it's not a joke, guys.
So if you guys know anybody,
I don't know if we have any connections there for you, but I think you're very good at genre work and would love to see you do more.
And Phil, remember, you work with the same actors.
Yes. So.
Yeah. I'm always reading the scripts like, is she British? Like,
I think
is that me?
For me, with my sensibilities, what I love about genre films is if you play it right, you can explore some really deep things in them. You know,
oh, yeah.
Some
yeah.
people assume it's just like, oh, it's just, you know, genre films are just all slashers and monster movies. Well, you could use a slasher or a monster as a vehicle to explore some very realistic personal issues that we all have. So I in my work, I always try to ground it in some sort of personal anxiety that I have and then explore it within a genre, if you will.
We actually discussed that a little bit during the episode about how you can use genre to explore other ideas without explicitly stating them.
Yes.
This isn't a question. I just want to let you know that part of this movie that made me like the most anxious was the part about writing the book. Because my father has been writing a book and theoretically should have turned it in 5 years ago. and it would be a lie to say it hasn't created some tension in his marriage to my stepmother. She's been, you know, hey, how's the book coming? So like that whole dynamic in this movie, I was just like, oh, ugh, I don't like this.
Maybe send him the movie and maybe it'll kick him into gear.
Well, has your stepmother made the cover yet?
No, not yet, but I wouldn't put it past her.
Chrissy, you got a question?
Yeah, I'm going to go simple here. You mentioned earlier, because I was curious, where did you find the house to film this? Like, where is that? Because it was a super cool house, and I was just like, ooh. I was trying to figure out, does that look like maybe upstate New York to me, or... Just, you know, whenever you showed when she was sitting in like in front of the window and you could see the outside, I was like, that's really beautiful. Like, I'd really like to know where that is. Where is it?
So it's in New Hope, Pennsylvania. And we found it on Airbnb. You might actually be able to vacation there still. I haven't checked in a while to see if it's still on there.
Oh, if it is, we should do a night there.
I know. When we visit back east, we should do a night there. I highly recommend if you're looking for a vacation house in New Hope, stay at that house. The bathtub's amazing. The view's amazing. And, you know, you might see some remnants of the honeymoon phase in there if you look close enough.
Have they fixed the wall?
I know Eric's not going to go because he doesn't like the bookcase.
Oh, yeah. That bookcase was, let's say, distracting to me.
I actually think that's the town that Gigi Hadid lives in, actually. Her mother bought like a mansion there or something.
I am actually writing that down because I might want to do that at some point. That sounds really fun.
Yeah, every now and then I see on Facebook, you know, they'll pass around the question of like, what house in a movie would you like to live in or would you like to have? And for a few years now, it's been like, I kind of like the underground bunker in Ex Machina. And okay. Because it's like on the waterfall, I think that's really cool. This one might edge that out. I really kind of like that house, just like that song. And as I discussed in the podcast, I like the bookshelf because it would drive my wife insane.
It's actually the town where Gigi does live, and Taylor Swift sent a gift to her there. I always have to get a Taylor Swift thing and everything.
Yes, every time yes, he does.
Yeah, Phil, we know you're psycho, but we love you anyway. Well,
are you a big Taylor Swift fan, Phil?
Yeah, I'm a Swiftie.
Yeah, my wife is too.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Yeah. Yes. But Phil and Chloe, I never told you, if that house is ever available and I, like, really make it, Joan and I have talked about all the time, like, buying it and moving there.
Yes. Like, this is
the house we want. This will be forever creepy and weird, and this is where we will raise our children. It's going to be great.
Isn't that like Jamie Lee Curtis buying the house where they filmed Halloween? I mean,
honestly,
is that really the house you want to go back to?
It's way weirder than that.
It's more like that movie Sinister, like where they moved into the serial killer's house. Yeah.
I actually, it's really strange because the movie Sinister, that house, when I saw the movie, I kept going, why does this house look familiar to me? And I couldn't figure out why. And then it turns out, on my way to work, on the corner down here, there is a house that was abandoned that somebody bought, and it looks exactly like the Sinister house on the outside, and they painted it the same color. And I went, oh, that's why I recognize the house. So, yeah, there are people who do it. There are people who do it because it's cool.
Now, Mike, what do you got?
Yeah, so I'm curious about on the filmmaking process. I haven't had a chance to see the deleted scenes. But, Phil, what goes in your head when you decide to cut movies? Right? Not cut movies, cut your scenes, right? You may have a scene that you really like. And I know there's an old adage that the movie's not done until you cut the scene that you love the most. And I know it has a lot. My father was a commercial editor. I know it has a lot to do with, like, say, the pacing, but there's also story elements you want to get in there. So, like, what was the scene like that hurt the most to cut in this film? And did you care about crushing your star's feelings that they lost their favorite scene, maybe? Or and what, where do you decide this has to go or this has to stay?
I mean, I pretty much just decide what will piss off Chloe and Jim the most, and then I know that's what I have to cut. But, no, you know, I'm also an editor, so I like to think I've developed a skill over the years of cutting my own films to where I'm not precious about what the material is. I'm very objective about it, and you know, with the film, it came down to just pacing and then also repetitive information. So if there was something that was already kind of talked about in the film from a idea perspective, you know, maybe not necessarily the exact words that we're saying, but what the idea behind the scene was, that kind of led me to believe that it was something that could be trimmed. Jim alluded to the scene with the kiss, the long take scene. The part of the scene that we cut was a confrontation between Tom, Eve, and the director hologram, where he pops up and he asks, you know, guys, what's going on? Is everything okay? And Tom's trying to say everything's fine, and Eve's saying she wants to go home. And it was similar to the LSD director hologram scene, and I just felt it, you know, if there was something that we could cut, that was one of them, because the content of it was very similar. Some of the other scenes that we cut, you know, came down to pacing, where it was probably like 6 or 7 minutes from the first act that we trimmed, because we felt like we wanted to get to the house sooner, because that's where the film really kind of kicks into gear. And then for the ending, the alternate ending that we had that we shot, that it was a tough call initially, because, you know, I wrote the script, so to cut out my ending that I wrote, you know, that's probably an extreme thing to do for most people. But having watched a few cuts of the film, I realized that for me, the movie ended when Tom and Eve's relationship ends. And this epilogue, it's really not even an alternate ending, it's more of an epilogue. It just felt like it didn't fit tonally with everything that had happened right before it. You know, like my interest in the film was over now because Tom and Eve's relationship was over. So I felt like that was actually better served as, you know, something on the DVD, but not necessarily within the core story. Now, some people will probably debate with me about whether or not that should have been included. And Jim, I feel like you're in the camp that probably would have preferred to have kept it. Even within our team, there's some contested debate about whether or not the epilogue should have been kept in there.
Well, I saw it and I liked it, and I understand why Jim wanted to keep it, because I saw they show a clip of him going through the makeup process on that. Didn't look like that fun. But I honestly think that you're right that it's an epilogue and it doesn't really continue the story, but I think the reason, the legitimate reason to think about keeping it would have been that then you know why you see all these clips of Tom in front of this stark white background, because without that you don't have that piece of information. That's the only thing. But I really liked the alternate ending. I thought it was pretty groovy.
Yeah, I probably pushed the boundaries of how much you can expect an audience to fill in the blanks on the movie, because I, you know, you always hear from people, it's like, oh yeah, I don't like to be spoon-fed as somebody in the audience. You know, I want to fill in the blanks myself. And I tried to respect the audience with the film, you know, by not spoon-feeding them every little thing. You know, why is Eve's belly growing exponentially? Well, if you think about the logic in the film, clone Tom has grown fast, so his DNA would then be mixed with her, you know, ovaries, and the baby that came out of it would be growing exponentially.
Well, and on
it was pancakes on demand.
Well, on this show, we've said in the past that it's okay if you don't give us all the answers, as long as you have all the answers.
Yes.
As long as you've thought it out in your head and you had that in mind while you were writing and shooting the thing, then it's cool to hold it back. But if you just didn't like think of that part, then that's where it gets a little upsetting. But clearly you did, because you shot it.
I completely agree with you. And we walked a fine line, especially with the ending, as you said, with explaining who Tom's talking to. But I think part of the fun of these types of films is those conversations that you have afterwards with people, where it's like, what do you think this mean? Or who do you think he was talking to there? Or which Tom actually was the real Tom? So we wanted to leave stuff in there for people to talk about at the end. But if you want the definitive answer, it still exists and it's on the DVD. So I figured it was kind of a best of both worlds. I think if I were to do it again, I probably would have put it at the very end of the credits and maybe left it in there. That way people, you know, could see it as an epilogue.
That's all popular now because of Marvel.
Yes, the Marvel.
All back. Yeah.
I have a question about the Dahmer Initiative. You brought in the actor that was the head of the Dahmer Initiative, Frank Kuo Chow. How did you get involved with him? Is he from the greater Lancaster, Philadelphia area as well, or how did he find out about you? All right.
So Francois's out here in California. And I was a huge fan of Lost when it was on TV. It's like my favorite series in the world. And when you're writing, you know, a lot of times you're picturing somebody to write towards. You know, like for me, I like to write towards actors. And Francois for me was actually always the director. And when it came time to cast the movie, I went out on a whim and just, you know, I found his email and I emailed him and I was like, hey, you know, I'm a huge fan of yours and your body of work. Would you be open to reading the script and considering playing the part in my first feature? And he was really flattered to get the message, and it kind of sparked this, you know, relationship where we were talking back and forth. He loved the script and, you know, he agreed to come on board the project. So it was really a dream come true getting to work with somebody like him and his caliber of, you know, acting.
Yeah, I just took a whim and it worked. That's great.
Yeah. I think a lot of filmmaking is just going out on a limb and asking, you know, because you never know if you unless you ask. So.
Right.
And we did discuss there's a lot of little Lost DNA, like with the Millennium Project food packages.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did bring that up. Yeah.
Like Dharma candy bars or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was saying, amazing. You know, why wasn't it Grey Goose? You know, it's this generic crap, you know, but what are you going
to do? I think that's part of, like, the overall, you know, creepiness of it. It's like their logo is branded on everything. So it's like a constant reminder that you can't escape the people watching you.
I was joking that there's probably a cut scene of Chloe's character standing next to that thing just going, vodka, 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 vodka.
No, really? Well, I just thought about this right now, but we should have just been like $50,000.
Yeah.
And then just leave. You're like, all right, there you go.
Well, I thought after
pill or something. More LSD.
Yeah,
more
right.
LSD.
I did have, when we were actually doing the show last week, I did almost think, or when I was watching the film, it did cross my mind. I was wondering if maybe the reason it was all branded food was because there was maybe chemicals in it or something too, that was either feeding after the movie was over and he was a clone. Maybe it was feeding his growth. I don't know if that was the intent, but you know, sometimes your mind just goes places. And I was like, well, they could be putting certain drugs in there. We don't know. Like, they, you know, they could be doing something. You know?
No, I love that. I love that idea.
Fertility medication.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
right, the horse pill, right? So, we've had you for about an hour, and obviously we don't want to take up your time forever and ever. But I guess anyone have any further questions? Well, like last question that we haven't got to that you guys wanted to ask. Anyone?
Well, I do.
Oh, you do. Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, Jim, congratulations on your pecs. I was wondering if you're just like that, or if you hit the gym any more than usual, knowing you were going to be shirtless a lot in this movie.
I even said that to my wife. I go, holy shit, that guy's huge.
That's what funny, she said. Jim. You and I completely failed at making you look like a, you know, dad bod.
Okay, so thank you. I appreciate it. That's very kind. I'm a stage actor and a personal trainer, and I have been for years.
Oh, okay.
During all that kind of fun stuff. And when I booked this role, Phil and I had a very long conversation about Tom is a writer in his early 20s. He probably can't afford a gym membership. Doesn't really sound like something he's into necessarily. He probably wouldn't look the way I look. And we were about 2 months out from filming, and I said, okay, Phil, we can go one of two ways with this. I can, because there's going to be nude scenes that we know are going to happen, we can really go for that, like, Brad Pitt shredded look because, you know, I've got 2 months and we can really do that. Or we can try to undo what I've spent 6 years doing. And Phil said, no, I think we should try to undo as much as we can because it makes sense. Because if Tom like takes his shirt off and we're like, whoa, washboard abs, oh my God, it doesn't really make sense. And I said, I agree, that makes total sense. Okay, so I ordered a pizza that night and I drank a 6-pack of beer. Went, all right, here we go. This is what we're going to do. And I spent 2 months I didn't work out for 2 months, and I ate as much garbage as I could to my wife's dismay. That's where we ended up.
Well, dear God, man, I'm sorry to tell you, you still look fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you. And
poor
like,
bastard.
We really failed at it. We found my photos on a porn website recently from the movie. It's not great.
What's the name of that website? No, it's
We really tried, and there's only so much you can do with where you're at a certain point. But thank you. No, our goal was to try and undo that, and it sort of worked.
Yeah, I mean, you have a before and after shot on your website, Jim, don't you? Your workout website?
I do. I have a before and after website, and it's really uncomfortable for me to look at. I don't like it. All
right. Well, you'll have to give us that website when we wrap things up here so we can go take a look.
But thank you again. I appreciate that.
And to be honest, you know, even if you were writing or whatever, yeah, I mean, you're young, you were supposed to be a young guy that was about to get married. You know, you could have been fit enough, you know, you could jog. I mean, it's all right. It's all good.
Yeah, so right.
It was real. It was real.
No, so, but I knew who I was starring against, and I didn't want to be heavy either. I was like, I gotta at least look like Chloe would be interested in me. So,
hey, those uniforms don't hide anything. So.
Yeah, that's I nearly killed Phil when I saw those uniforms. I was like, no, I was like, make them black, and I was like 10, 15 pounds heavier than I was in the movie, and I was like, oh my god, I'm gonna have to lose so much weight. And I just, like, went on this insane unhealthy diet to try and lose it. And I had, like, three pairs of Spanx on. I had one, like, on my belly. I had one that came over my top. And, like, I already don't have a butt. And these Spanx went, so, like, I had no, like, just no curves at all because I was just trying to be thin.
Yeah, 2 weeks before filming, Phil went, yeah, these are the costumes. I went, oh, man. We should have gone the other way. We really should have gone the other way, Phil. This is the wrong decision.
Couldn't have made them black.
Jim, have you worn the costume since?
That's a weird question.
He only wears it when he's practicing.
Like, they gave me the costumes at the end. I have used it at the gym a couple times.
Yes.
And it's always fun. those are my running leggings, though. I do use those anytime I go running.
Nice.
It's great because it's just starting to get a little bit cooler now. But yeah, I have worn them.
One of these podcast interviews, you're gonna just have to surprise us and wear.
Oh my god, you totally should.
Yeah, Chloe, you totally should.
I can't do that anymore. This was 3 years ago when I was thin. I ain't maintaining that body now.
Look, my wife and I had a kid. I haven't maintained anything.
Well, I'll say one thing. Keep on doing the festivals and conventions because, again, that's the reason why Mike said, oh, it's Doom. I met him. Let's do this episode. So, you know, it actually gets people to know who you are. Besides, you know, just randomly seeing it on finding it on iTunes or whatnot. So that
right.
was good.
And I really liked Stay Quiet, your short film. And so when you said you were involved in honeymoon phase, I made sure I remembered it. And I reached out and friended you on Facebook. You know, I've made a few friends that way, you know, because I saw a short thing they did and they were working on a bigger project. I was enthused about that. So that's always a good thing. I do think there's a sequel potential here.
So we...
Because Tom goes off. I think there's a story about Tom with clone Chloe. I think that's clone Eve. I think there's a story there. We can let Chloe get her evil on.
I actually
right,
think
try to,
better...
try to impregnate Jim.
Jesus, Mike. I'm listening.
I feel like the better story is John and Julie, the Tempur-Pedic pillow couple. Like, I want to know what went down in their house.
True.
And it probably lasted 5 minutes before clone John was like, fuck this.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, were they I can't imagine they were using the old ladies for breeding experiments, so I imagine there were different experiments that were going on. Or he was just a terrible doctor.
Now my grandmom actually is one of the couples. She's in the boardroom scene with her boyfriend at the time. They were both in there, so that was a lot of fun getting them in there. We tried to get all ranges of relationships in that boardroom.
My grandma's on the cloning screen at the end, and I was like, can I just take a picture of you? She's like, oh, for your film? Like, she has no idea what the film's about. I just tell her it's a nice film that she can never watch, and her face is, like, plastered on it. Can you just sign this non-release form, Grandma? Thank you.
Yeah. I just thought of another question. In regards to Tom, or clone Tom, I guess, his sudden desire to have a child, was that something that just happened with his wonky programming, for lack of a better word? Or is that something that was done intentionally by the experiment?
That's a really good question. I'm curious about that, too.
So, thinking back on it, I think one of the things that we talked about was the idea that Tom is... he's a new person himself. He was just born... he's young, but he's now in an adult's body. And I think there's like that fascination of creator and creation, you know, like he wants to create something the same way that he was just created. You know, and it ties into that idea of, you know, him being a child himself. And, you know, he sees this young baby in the horror movie that he's watching, and he just becomes obsessed. You know, that becomes his childlike obsession.
Mr. Bean, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that scene in the fake horror movie was hilarious, by the way.
Thank you.
That was awesome.
That was our AD was in that scene. Yeah. When the goo went all over his face, that was a lot of fun.
Awesome. All right, so before we get final stuff from
hold on. Billy, we did have one last question we need you to settle, though, because this was a dispute. Okay, yeah. At the end, we had a dispute on the podcast whether or not that was the real Tom or the fake Tom who survived, and whether or not two Toms, if either one was in fact the real Tom.
So, yeah, because we were saying, could there be multiple clones, not just one clone?
What's everybody's opinion?
I've changed mine since we recorded the podcast. After watching it a second time, my opinion has changed.
I felt it was a clone, whether it was the same clone or a third clone. And the reason is because he was still obviously violent, and he wasn't the same personality as the original Tom that we had met earlier. So that was my opinion.
Yeah.
I thought they were both clones.
Okay.
I thought it was the clone. Just because after he chokes her and then he's all crying, that to me was just like, okay, that's like an emotional imbalance there. That's something like a little kid would do.
Yeah.
So that's why I thought it was a clone. But, you know, I don't think there's a... So anyway...
I originally thought it was the real Tom, and he was just a psycho the whole time. But upon second watch, I now realize it's a clone.
All right, see, I told you, Eric, it wasn't the same.
Maybe you were just picking up on Jim.
I just said I was wrong, Phil. You don't got to rub it in.
Yeah, I apologize.
Jim, what's the answer?
I mean, at least for my money, it was real Tom got shot and clone Tom survived. Because he had learned to manipulate Eve to a point where he knew he could make a sacrifice and still get what he wanted.
Yeah.
Chris, his reaction to his actions are very childlike, and that was a huge part of that ending. Is that what he doesn't understand the consequences of until it's too late. And that's why I love that scene. Which we also shot on the third day of filming, by the way. The ending scene was day 3 of filming.
So not in sequence.
Not in sequence, definitely.
Can you imagine if that scene happened and he did resuscitate Eve, how their marriage would be from then onwards? Would just be...
Because he doesn't try for very long, you know? No. Maybe she does open her eyes.
That would be rough.
That would be a total disaster, yeah.
That would be. But I'm glad that
she got better.
I'm glad that it's a conversation piece, though. You know, as the writer, that was something that I wanted from the ending of the film, is I wanted people to debate, you know, what they thought. Was that the clone Tom, or was that real Tom? And he was always capable of it. So, you know, as the writer-director, what Jim said, that was the intent behind my interpretation of it, is that the clone Tom makes it out at the end, and, you know, through that childlike... rampage, he accidentally kills Eve and then feels regret for it. But it's fun to hear people's theories about it and everything, because in the film, you know, it's not necessarily conclusive, so it leaves things open, you know, for the future and for interpretations.
If you watch the alternate ending, it removes all doubt.
Yes, it does.
Well, I'm
but maybe the alternate ending is him saying, that sucked, I'm going to do something else.
All right, so let's see, let's get stuff that you guys are working on, if you want to promote any of the stuff that you've already done, you know, stuff like that, you know, because I'm sure some of the listeners would definitely want to check out more of your stuff and then follow you guys, what you're doing and whatnot. So why don't we start with you, Jim?
You can find me at
Jim Shubin, S-C-H-U-B-I-N, on all the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Are there others? I'm sure there are. I don't know. social medias, email, etc. My website is www.jimshubin.com. I've done a couple virtual concerts since the pandemic started. I'm going to be on a couple different websites for different musicians promoting their work. I'm recording my first audiobook, which will be coming out in the next 6 months, which is great. But for actors right now, there's not a ton going on. So I'm just enjoying being home with my wife and son and enjoying getting to promote this film and having this going on right now. But if you want to check out anything I've done, anything coming up, Jim Shubin on IMDb, Jim Shubin on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, any of those kind of things.
Very good. All right. What about you, Chloe and Phil? You guys are together, so you guys probably have a lot of things together as well. So
yeah, so post-honeymoon phase, I started writing what I hope will be my second feature. There's an Easter egg in the honeymoon phase. The book that Tom's writing, Stuck in Our Heads, that's the title of my next screenplay. Cool. So there's a hint in there for anybody that watches the honeymoon phase. But it's a 180 from my last film. It's a coming-of-age high school dramedy about this senior high school girl who has a panic attack one night, and it unlocks this invisible doppelganger, basically like imaginary friend and personification of her anxiety. So she has to spend the rest of senior year trying to find a way to put her anxiety back in her head so that she can get on with her life. And it has to do with, you know, some genre, different genre film making styles too, where her different panic attacks are explored in different genres. So there's like a Final Destination sequence where she's imagining everything that could go wrong at the theme park. There's, you know, disaster movie stuff. So it's a lot of fun. I'm hoping to package that up within the next few months and hit the road and try and get that made next year. And then in the meantime, between working on that, I'm peddling the honeymoon phase DVD, which comes out September 29th. It has all the behind the scenes, deleted scenes, that alternate ending that Jim loves so much, and he's probably going to make his own cut of the film with it. Mm-hmm. And bloopers, all the fun stuff, which is also available on the iTunes version.
And Phil, where could they potentially buy that DVD?
So the DVD is available at all the major retailers, Walmart, Target, Best Buy, Amazon. Chloe and I will be at Walmart tomorrow taking a look at it, as I'm sure Jim is. I know it's for everybody listening, they're probably like, stop telling us where we can buy your stuff. I just want to say, as a first-time filmmaker, it is just so exciting to see your movie on a DVD rack. Like, when we got the package with the DVDs in there, it was, like, literally just tearing up, because you spend years of your life working on something, and then finally, it really just all comes down to this little disc. And all the hours of work just get packaged into this little box, and it's just really cool. So
it's literally a dream come true. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So if you do like thrillers, if you like Black Mirror, sci-fi type stuff, check out the movie. I'm on Twitter at Phil Carroll Jr., Facebook also. And I love talking to people about films. So please hit me up if you want to talk. So.
And if you like horror films or like to watch short horror films, I run my own company called Fear Crypt. And we have a YouTube channel with a bunch of short horror films. And if you have a YouTube channel and you subscribe, I will be forever in your debt. I'm trying to build a YouTube channel. So
tell them about the big news with the one from TikTok.
Oh, someone did a review on TikTok of this one film that we did called Delicious. And normally I only get like a few thousand views on my short films. And this one got a reaction on TikTok and then got into the algorithm after we did a Film Courage interview. And it's up to, as of yesterday, 145,000 views, which
you
is like
viral,
like really cool for me. I'm like, oh my god, no one ever watches my stuff, so this is really exciting. So, yeah.
What was that, Jim?
It's 159,000 today.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I was able to like start monetizing and stuff. So it's the first time I've been able to like actually have a real YouTube channel, which was exciting.
So is your, I'm really, really love short horror, short films. Like I'm really into the short film thing, probably because I'm a short story writer. But that's called what? Fair Crypt?
Fair Crypt, yeah. So
F-A-I-R, so that's where I can find you.
No,
F-E-A-R.
As in scary.
Fair Crypt. Okay, got it.
It's Mac.
And if I put that into YouTube, I should just be able to find you.
Yeah, if you type that in, and it's on all social medias too.
Okay, cool.
I think faircrypt.com, that's your website.
Yeah, faircrypt.com, and then just Fair Crypt on everything. But yeah, so if you like short horrors, let me know what you guys think.
Yeah, I do, and I have lots of friends that are into horror short films too, so I'll just start sharing them.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chrissy always goes up to Portland, Maine every year to their short horror festival that they have, and obviously Damn this year it was canceled, so yeah.
Awesome.
Well, they're doing Lovecraft Film Fest is online. All these film festivals are online this year.
Yeah,
so right. I've actually been able to go to like Cthulhuthon, which is the big Lovecraft one, which is 50 short films.
Whoa.
You know, but I can't, I'm living the East Coast. It's thousands of dollars for me to go to Oregon. So I'm kind of excited that I just get to sit in my living room for $100 for the weekend and watch them all, you know? So, right. Yeah.
If you like cool. watching them, I can send you all my screeners of the ones that aren't out yet for your just opinion as a writer too.
I would love that. Oh my God. I would love that. I would love that.
Oh yeah. I'm always looking for like people that. Who like don't know me, who will give me like actual criticism and not sugarcoat anything. So yeah. Yeah. If you like watching shorts, I have a bunch that I can
that
send.
That would be fantastic. Do you Thank want you. Me to just send you an email or what do you want me to do?
Yeah. If you just email me and then I'll send you, there's one particular I can just send you right now too. That's cool. Sorry, I'm keeping everyone on. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, and if you come back to the East Coast at some point to do another film festival like you did the Poconos, you know, please let us know, and I'll certainly try to make it.
Absolutely, yeah. That would be awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, we plan on shooting our future projects there as well. You know, we're in California to hopefully take care of the business side of things and then bring our work to Pennsylvania to shoot with people like Jim Shubin. So,
so if anyone wants to be an extra.
Ooh, also, keep
all people right here. I'm
in mind for any acting roles. I know the industry's closed pretty much right now, but as things open up, these are two undiscovered talents that we really hope the honeymoon phase, you know, helps launch their careers.
We only do stuff with intense sex scenes, just so you know. It's just like
that's
a pretty,
required,
like, that's something that we have to have that.
And only with each other, so.
That... No other actors.
With daddy watching and directing.
Oh, God.
If you thought what we did with a curling iron was extreme, wait till you see what we do with an egg beater.
Let's edit that out, please.
Did he just say egg beater?
Chloe just
picked up. Mike
sees the film, then I guess. Like you said, yeah.
Mike worries us sometimes.
Yes, Mike. Jeez, Mike. All right, so yeah, we appreciate that you came on, and it's always good to have new talent. We love promoting indie films and stuff like that, and you guys had a first-class feature for sure, directing, editing, writing, and as we always say, actors as well, and you actors were great. So we appreciate that you came on, and we can hopefully get some people to check out your film and maybe even buy the DVD at Walmart, Amazon, Target, Best Buy, wherever.
All places.
Well, buy it at all the places. Buy one from each.
Buy all the things.
Get the Best Buy edition with the Best Buy price tag, the Target edition with the red circle on it. Get them all.
That's right. And then get the VOD iTunes as well. Do it all.
But honestly, on this podcast, this is the kind of moment that we love. I think we've talked about it in the past. One of our favorite things about doing the podcast is coming across a movie like this that's really good that not a whole lot of people know about, and trying to get the word out. So we're certainly going to do that with the honeymoon phase. You guys did great. We loved it. And we hope to see you do more in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much, Eric. You know, from the beginning, our film was a very much a grassroots project where our original pitch video that we made, it was for a competition and there was a Facebook public vote. And whoever won the public vote went to this fellowship called Shutter Labs. And Chloe and I ended up winning that and through the help of everybody rallying behind the film. So, you know, we don't have any mainstream coverage of the movie. It's all kind of a grassroots effort of YouTubers and bloggers and podcasts. So we really appreciate you guys having us on the show and lending us your audience to talk about our movie and to you know, hopefully win over some new fans for it. So thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you guys.
I really appreciate your time. It's been fantastic.
Maybe we won't do too much ending stuff because if we add the interview to this episode, it will expand the episode to it further anyway, assuming we do get the filmmakers interviewed.
I do want to mention one thing real quick, Phil.
Sure.
Which is that I watched a new series available on Netflix called Ratched. It's about Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's a prequel. And I think a lot of people that listen to the show would dig it.
Yeah, absolutely. Based off of it's a prequel to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the movie, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what it was supposed to be. Written by Ken Casey. The novel, that is. All right, sounds good. Let's finish up a little house cleaning here before we get into our final thoughts of this film here. So, Erica, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called The Ascanty Podcast. That's spelled ASKANCITY. You can find it wherever you got this one.
All right, very good. And Mike, you, me, and Eric do another podcast?
Yes. I was regretting that one for a moment. That is Cinema a la Carte. In Cinema a la Carte, we cover films. It's a monthly podcast. We cover films that don't really fit neatly under the Dark Discussions umbrella, although that may vary from film to film. And so we rotate, each of us picking a movie that we want to cover. And our most recent one was Jack Reacher. Before that was Collateral. Before that was, I think, Forbidden Planet. Before that, I think, was Inside Out. And some of them have been released. I don't know how many. I've kind of lost track.
All right, very good. And, Mike, we're doing a podcast on an HBO television series?
Yeah, we're doing a podcast on the HBO TV series Lovecraft Country with you and me and Barrett and Kevin Letts. And that we just covered episode 6. Meet me in, what was the name of the city?
Daegu.
Meet me in Daegu. Thank you. And there's four more episodes left.
Fourth largest city in South Korea. But anyway, yep, four episodes left. Continue, Mike. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so there's four episodes left, and those we're recording typically Tuesday or Wednesday, and they're dropping a day or two after that. So if you're watching that series and would like to catch up on us, then we'd welcome you to listen in.
Yep, absolutely. We did get some feedback from one of our listeners, Blocky Block, which is probably just one of those
screen names.
I guess that's not the word I'm looking for, but that's good enough. Yeah, Blocky Block, and you see him a lot on our The Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group, and he wrote that. The Cloverfield Killer is a great movie, and the discussion by all you guys was fantastic.
So, great, thanks.
Yes, yeah, thank you very much for that. It's always good that for feedback, and it's always good that we're entertaining folks because that's one of the reasons we're here. Chrissy, you do things.
I do. I write short fiction. I have a literary magazine, and you can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
Excellent. All right, so let's get around table here of our thoughts in this film, final thoughts. So what's that with you, Chrissy?
I really, really enjoyed this film. I think it's a really great psychological thriller. I love that it's like a science, it's got a science fiction vibe to it. I think the twists are interesting and just as well as justified. If you look back over the film, you can definitely see that we were indeed given clues. I think it makes great use of single effect. I don't know. I just really enjoyed this movie. I'm looking forward to watching it a second time. And I think it's going to appeal to not only fans of psychological thrillers, but more than likely fans of films that center on romantic relationships. Blah. Sorry, that took me 3 times to get out. Yeah. So I'm going to give this one a high recommend. I've already recommended it to a few people, too. So, yes.
All right. Very good. Let's go with you, Eric.
I liked this movie. It left me with a lot of questions. I do want to watch it again to see if I can try and straighten some stuff out in my own head. And I really hope we get a chance to talk to the filmmakers so we could ask them questions directly. Overall, I would say it's a pretty decent movie, and check it out.
Excellent. Yeah, for me, it's a solid film. We definitely had some questions. I wouldn't call them nitpicks, but just trying to figure out things because the movie is intentionally a puzzle. It's a really solid film. The acting's great. The set design was good, even if there were some OCD issues for a few folks. Story was interesting. It had grindhouse aspects, and it was science fiction, which is always a good thing. Mike?
Yeah, I enjoyed the film quite a bit. Like I said, on first watch, there's some stuff I wasn't too sure of, but I think it was well-directed. The production design for a low-budget film is fantastic because the house is awesome, including the bookcase, because OCD people deserve to be driven mad.
Exactly. I agree.
And the two leads are really, really phenomenal, I think. I might very well just peg them for my performances to savor category when we do a year-end wrap-up.
Right. And she was easy on the eyes, Mike. Easy on the eyes. And Abe?
I thought this was overall a really good film. I thought the performances were strong from our two leads. I like this examination of relationships and human emotions. It's, you know, especially when through a lens of psychological thriller and science fiction, I think it always makes for some really good storytelling and raises interesting questions. And it's definitely a film I could see having to watch more than once to look for certain clues and cues that you might have missed. It does leave it, but it also feels like a film that it kind of leaves some answers that will never be, you know, never get the answers to, regardless of how many times you go through it. So it might be one that has you build your own conclusions. I like the first half more than the second half, but overall, I think it's a film I can recommend. I do hope we get a chance to speak to the filmmakers. I think it'll be a very interesting discussion, and those are my thoughts.
All right, very good. So, once again, this is The Honeymoon, 2020, August 21st release everywhere. IMDb calls it horror sci-fi thriller. It is directed by Philip G. Carroll and also written by him. It stars his wife, Chloe Carroll, as well as Jim Shubin and Francois Chow. And the film is readily available anywhere VOD can be found, both for purchase or rental. It is from Dark Sky, as Eric mentioned, which usually releases some pretty good genre films. And with all that stated, Eric, why don't you leave us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in. Let's talk about the honeymoon phase. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.